remember.
Open the House Interim Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. Today is Tuesday, September the 19th. Good morning, everybody. Hope your summer breaks have been enjoyable. Sorry that you have to come back to work at some point, but it's the way life works. We're going to have a series of informational meetings today, but before we do that, we need to adopt committee rules so we can function. So maybe Madam Vice Chair, if you would be willing to...
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules that we have copies of.
Vice Chair McLean moves to adopt the proposed committee rules. These are pretty standard. You've probably already done this in another committee yesterday. Any discussion? Any objections? Okay, without objection, the committee rules are adopted. Let's open our informational meeting and start with the Sudden Oak Death Task Force Strategic Action Plan and ask Representative Brock Smith to get us started. Do you want to bring Mark up with you to get? Okay, great.
And Sarah.
And Sarah? Okay, good. Get you all up at once.
Yeah. I'll sit over here and then I'll leave and let him take over.
All right.
Is that okay? I'll leave and then I'll work.
Let me make one comment before we get going on this, just for those of you who are interested. Representative Brock Smith and I had a conversation about forest fires and fire updates, and our challenge was we have people that were the ones we'd want to talk to who are still actively out there fighting fires. And so there were some committees that had, I don't know if they did it in person or by video or what, but there were two committees that had updates about fire yesterday, but we're planning on spending most of our November meeting on it when we're not actively fighting fires. So I just wanted to comment on that because it's noticeably missing. I had actually asked to have a briefing, and then as the fires kept going and going and going, and we had a hard time getting a hold of folks because they were busy fighting fires, we weren't sure that was such a good idea to pull them away from a fire to come talk to us right at the moment. So anyway, that's the fire situation.
And Chair Clem, I really appreciate your leadership on that effort, so thank you very much.
You bet.
I look forward to those conversations in November. So as many of you know, I'm Representative David Brock Smith, House District 1, Charleston to the California border over to West Cave Junction and up to West Roseburg. Pretty much take in all of the Sudden Oak Death in the state of Oregon. And to my right is Sarah Navarro, and to my extended right is the famous Commissioner Mark Labhart. And I appreciate his work on the task force as well. Just a little brief overview. When I was county commissioner for Curry County, we began this task force. We were grateful for Senator Merkley's co-convening of the task force with me. And we really put it into full swing here after the first of the year. Multiple work groups did incredible work. And it was actually during session where we came out with their strategic plan at the end of May. That prompted, of course, an amendment to a bill for resources, as it was the task force and the experts within it that decided that really a $1.7 million annual work was critical to the management of the NA1 strain of Sudden Oak Death, which is what you see there, and the eradication of the EU1 strain, which is in your handout here, is near the Pistol River area. And as Representative McEwen knows, and members of course, the Coastal Caucus, as this is was their one of their main priorities during the session. A lot of investment has been undertaken by the state for the Port of Coos Bay, and there are still investments ongoing. We know that within the next 12 years or so, the NA1 strain of sod will be under current management practices in the Coos and Coos County timber market, which the quarantines that are associated with that could be devastating for exports not just with timber resources, but other nursery stock as well. But more critical than that is the EU1 lineage of sudden oak death. And the EU1 lineage is far more aggressive, and it affects conifers and Douglas fir. And so with that, I'll let the expert Commissioner Labhart come forward, and then I will come back up to the dais and let our Director of Forestry come up.
Okay, good morning, Chair Clem, Vice Chair McLean, and representatives. For the record, my name is Mark Labhart, and I'm a retired Tillamook County Commissioner, but I'm doing some part-time work for the Association of Oregon Counties under the County Solutions Program, and I'm the Sudden Oak Death Facilitator. I've been working for the last year on this project. But I want to start off with some really good news. I drove over from Sisters this morning, and I was in a significant snowstorm on top of Hoodoo Pass. It rained almost all night in Sisters, and it was raining heavily all the way to Detroit. And so that is great news for the fires. I'm sure there's going to be some slides and landslides and those kind of things, but it's great news for the firefighters out there that are doing the heroic work of working on these fires. So just wanted to give you that good news, raining hard. So in the next 20 minutes or so, what we plan on doing is I'm going to give you a brief overview of the task force, what the recommendations were, and then specifically Chair Clem and Representative Smith have asked for a specific talk about the EU1 strain. And so Sarah Navarro, who is a fourth pathologist for the Department of Forestry, is going to zero in on the EU1 strain, and we'll leave 10 to 15 minutes for questions that you might have in regards to that. So that's what's going to be covered. So this is the latest map that Sarah provided me just recently that shows you the sudden oak death locations. We're mostly in Curry County, as you see here. And it's pretty detailed, but I just want to show you all those little dots are areas of lineage of both NA1 and EU1. So this gives you a perspective, and you can see up in the corner there, this is about where we're talking about in the state of Oregon here with Curry County. So in the spring of 2017, there was a sudden oak death task force convened by Senator Jeff Merkley and Representative Smith. This is the very first meeting of the task force. And I can tell you, this was a fairly significantly powerful task force. We had the regional forester, the director of BLM, the director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. This is the agency heads that attended this meeting and participated in the process. We had a number of subcommittee meetings. In fact, we had 12 throughout the year of subcommittee meetings, but this was the task force that approved the strategic plan unanimously. Here's some of the partners. I should say some. Here's all of the partners that worked on this. I'll take a minute and go through some of these. Natural Resource Conservation Service, significant representation by the tribes along the Oregon coast and in Northern California. You can see the Small Woodlands Association, Wild Rivers Land Trust. It was both environmental groups, industry groups, state agencies, federal agencies, associations, researchers, OSU School of Forestry, the cities, City of Brookings, City of Port Orford, Oregon Department of Transportation, a significant membership of this group. We tried to be completely comprehensive across the board. It isn't just ownerships, it's people that have a strong interest in what sod is and what sod can potentially do if it's not contained. So this is a quote from Senator Merkley. Oregon has a long history of pioneering innovative ways to resolve urgent natural resource issues, who convened the task force with Representative Brock Smith. He said, I'm proud that in a time of political divisiveness, we in Oregon are coming together to tackle a pressing issue for our southern counties. Sudden oak death and EU1 are too great a problem for one agency or one level of government to solve. With the potential for devastating impacts on our local economy, environment, this task force will work collaboratively to look for more and better solutions to fight the pathogen. And you see right here, I actually was not asleep. I was blinking. I swear I was blinking at that point in time. I was not asleep. So,
him and breathing.
Two charges were given. So remember that when you're up at the dais. Be careful what pictures they take of you. There are two charges that were given by the task force, to the task force, one by the legislature and one by the mission statement of the group. The direction from the Legislature Emergency Board in the fall of 2016 was as follows. AOC has been asked by the Oregon Legislature to convene and facilitate a task force on sudden oak death comprised of critical partners. The task force will assess the work that has been accomplished so far, how the results of these efforts have been, and develop a strategic action plan moving forward, which will include how this plan will be funded. The task force may identify additional work tasks. And then the task force identified a mission statement. They said, our mission is to develop a collaboration-based action plan, including the securement of adequate resources to contain NA1 pathogen and eradicate the EU1 pathogen. And we'll talk about the difference between those two, or Sarah will, the difference between NA1 and EU1 in a little bit. The task force agreed to develop a collaboration-based action plan to contain sudden oak death and eradicate the EU1 virus using the best available science. Again, mentioned to you, there was 12 meetings to develop a strategic action plan from six subcommittees. The subcommittees made some recommendations. This is the full report. If you'd like a copy, we can make it available to you. But this is the full report. I'm just going to quickly summarize the recommendations that came out of that. So there was a committee on communication and civic engagements. Their recommendations included a communication and a civic engagement strategy for both the public, the property owners, and agencies that are interested in the subject. The core science group has already been a group that's been functioning very well for a number of years. And they developed recommendations for providing information on the latest science and research that's still needed and recommendations. This is a key component of addressing disease management. There's a number of diseases that affect Oregon's trees, shrubs, nurseries, and those kind of things. Research and science is critical to making sure that we can address some of these diseases. So the science committee is pushing hard for some further research on how to contain and control this disease. Then there's a subcommittee called Adaptation, and they developed strategies to deal with the effects of sod on fire danger, transportation, public safety, and how to be proactive with sod. This is a picture of the Chetco Bar fire in Curry County, where five homes were destroyed. And the fire did get close, and Sarah can talk about it in some detail, but did get close to some of the areas that were affected. You saw in the very first slide the dead trees that come from sudden oak death contribute. When you have dead trees, they contribute significantly to increased fire danger. There's another committee called Public, Private, and Civic Funding. This committee identified funding strategies and proposals, as well as agreed to lobby for funding as identified by the other groups. There's an all-lands committee. This is made up mainly of the property owners. Committee developed recommendations to engage the public, tribal, and private property owners working and coordinating together to ensure all entities have an interest integrate their efforts in a seamless fashion. Currently, we're working on the final edits of a memorandum of understanding among the major landowners and interest groups. And we've met with the Forest Service and the BLM and private property owners and ODOT, and we're finalizing that memorandum of understanding right now, and it should be signed within the next month. A group called Economic Impacts and Workforce Training made recommendations to develop an economic impact study of sudden oak death now and into the future. What does this mean to our economy in Oregon? What does it mean to our export economy? What does it mean for Southern Oregon? A committee recommended the development of a workforce plan in addition to that to help implement the recommendations from the subcommittees and the SOD task force, and a workforce needs to create jobs to help treat the disease in infested areas. So there's two scenarios that the task force recommended for funding. One was introduced in House Bill 3151 by co-conveners David Brock Smith, and with an amendment to fund SOD implementation of $1.7 million for the biennium. Bill had the support of the Coastal Caucus. In fact, it was their number one legislative priority. The bill did not move out of Ways and Means. Scenario number two, federal funding. For fiscal year 18, appropriations requests have been submitted by Senator Merkley on behalf of the task force, and that's in Appendix B of our report. The SOD task force asked for the following: BLM $550,000, U.S. Forest Service, $380,000, and OSU Research, $1.2 million. And I might say that Senator Merkley so far has been successful in getting $2 million of additional funding for the APHIS program that will be used for nurseries and those kind of things. APHIS is the directly involved with sod research. So I'm going to turn it over to Sarah right now, and then we'll move right into questions.
Can you hit my phone?
Oh, yeah. So can you, how about you just tell me when to flip it?
For the record, Chair Clem, Vice Chair McLean, my name is Sarah Navarro, and I'm the forest pathologist with the Oregon Department of Forestry, and I am the program lead for the Sudden Oak Death Program. Go next.
I'm trying. There we go.
Prior to 2015, only one of the four lineages or strains of sudden oak death had been found in Oregon forests. This is the North American strain, or the NA1 strain. Two other lineages, the NA2 and EU1, had previously been detected in infested nurseries in Oregon, but not in any forests in the United States. The EU1 lineage has been a great concern to forestry officials in the United Kingdom. There, they have experienced severe mortality in their Japanese larch plantations. Over 30,000 acres have been clear-cut to control the disease there, as you can see in the top photo on the left. There, the disease is called sudden larch death and not sudden oak death. They also have observed mortality in other conifer tree species where they are grown in close proximity to these infected Japanese larch, such as Douglas fir, Grand fir, and Port Orford cedar. In early 2015, the EU1 lineage was detected on a single tan oak tree near the Pistol River. This was the first report of the EU1 lineage in U.S. forests. Genetic analysis suggests that a nearby private nursery, now closed, is the probable source. The finding is of particular concern because in Europe, the EU1 lineage kills or damages several conifer tree species and is considered more aggressive than our NA1 lineage. Furthermore, establishment of the EU1 lineage would create the potential for sexual reproduction and increased variability in the North American Phytophthora morum population. This single tree in 2015 was treated with a 13-acre sudden oak death eradication treatment. Then in 2016, the EU1 lineage was detected for a second time about a half mile south of the 2015 tree. Of the 25 infected trees identified, two grand fir seedlings and 23 tan oaks were confirmed positive for EU1. The 2016 infestation was treated with a 51-acre treatment using funding from the Emergency Board as well as the Oregon Invasive Species Council. And now in 2017, we have continued intensive ground surveys in the area and have detected 126 infected trees, including tan oaks, grand fir, and Douglas fir seedlings. We are still awaiting lineage testing on many of these infected trees, but we anticipate treating over 400 acres for the EU1 lineage. Recently, Dr. Jared Leboldis, forest pathology professor at Oregon State University, has completed multiple comparison studies of our Oregon NA1 and EU1 strains. On inoculated logs of Douglas fir, tan oak, western hemlock, Sitka spruce, big leaf maple, and Oregon white oak, cankers caused by EU1 were twice the size of cankers caused by NA1. In a laboratory sporulation study, neither NA1 or EU1 produces spores on Douglas fir or western hemlock. However, on tan oak, EU1 produces 2 to 3 times more spores than NA1. And then in the last study, seedlings of Douglas fir, Sitka spruce, western hemlock, and western larch were planted under EU1-infected trees as well as NA1-infected trees. At the conclusion of this experiment, 3 to 4 times more trees were infected under the EU1 trees than under the NA1 trees. At this point, we do believe we have the opportunity to eradicate the EU1 lineage from Oregon forests. The infestations are in a geographically small area, and we know more now about the disease biology and effective treatment buffer sizes than when the program started in 2001.
I think we're ready for questions now, if you have any.
Yeah, Vice Chair McLean.
Well, on that last item between the two strains, what are some of those solutions or the differences in the treatment between those two? Is it all buffers?
Chair Clem, Representative, it is all buffers. So we are proposing doing a 600-foot treatment buffer on these EU1 infestations as opposed to a 300-foot treatment buffer that we typically do for NA1 infestations. When we first started the program in 2001, we were only doing 50-foot buffers, but at that time, there was many unknowns about the disease biology, epidemiology, and spread.
And then my last one is, basically, because of the fire and the spread of the fire, and I know you said dead trees cause, you know, forest fires, but I mean, it's also those dead trees are, does the fire spread it more, is what I'm saying.
Chair Clem, Representative, so far the Checo Bar fire has burned in only a few of our sudden oak death infestations, and we do not believe that the fire causes the disease to spread at all. So the disease is produced by spores that are on the canopy of the trees and then aerially spread. However, it's usually only during rainy, moist, wet periods, and we've had a really dry summer down there in Brookings, so we don't anticipate the fire to be spreading. I am working in collaboration with pathologists at the U.S. Forest Service as well as Oregon State University to write up a grant proposal to look at the effects of the Checo Bar fire on our sudden oak death infestations in Oregon.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative McEwen.
Chair Clem, I truly appreciate the good representative's work, your work, the senator's work on this. This is just truly an existential issue for those of us on the South Coast. The beauty of having the rains come, and we've had a lot of rain on the South Coast in the last 2 days, is that they put out the fires, but they also spread this disease. Mm-hmm. So there's an upside and a downside to water where we come from. And I guess one of the questions I have is, you know, the bottom line is we need money to eradicate this disease. We weren't as successful as we had hoped in this session. In the Oregon legislature, I know our congressional delegation is working very hard. What's the bottom line? Where are we now? What do you need?
Chair Clem, Representative McEwen, for the record, I'm Peter Doherty, and I serve as the Oregon State Forester and the Director of the Department of Forestry. As Sarah mentioned, we have 310 confirmed acres of EU1, and with a 600-foot buffer, we expect that to be about $1.24 million dollars of cost. There's another 115 acres unconfirmed, but likely, and that would be another $460,000. Our base budget was $265,000 with about $125,000 for treatment. At this last legislative session, there was another $450,000 of treatment funds targeted explicitly at EU1. With the funding from ODF, U.S. Forest Service, APHIS, and BLM funding, if that comes through, we have about $1.268 million for treatments. Prior to the unconfirmed but highly likely, we had and stated at Penoir that we had enough funding to treat the EU1. Right now, we're thinking there's a gap of about $431,000 to fully treat all acres of EU1 if, in fact, all 115 are confirmed.
So follow up. So you need a half a million. Mm-hmm. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
It would take a half a million dollars to treat all of the EU1.
And that would get us to a point of eradication?
It's just for
EU1. Right.
And while we think we're going to be highly successful in eradication and we have an opportunity to hold it, note the amount of spores produced by EU1 are twice as much as NA1. It is a new strain. We are being aggressive as what we think is needed. But with any invasive species, you know, I can't promise eradication. That is our goal.
So because it produces twice as many spores, that's the increase in the buffer size?
Correct.
Okay.
Representative Brock Smith.
Thank you. And thank you, Director. And thank you, Sarah, for all your great work on this. I know that this has been something that you've been working on for a very long time. And I really appreciate it. The problem with BLM funding, Mark, do you want to get into that a little bit or not?
Chair Clem, Representative Smith, the BLM has indicated just recently through an email that because of lack of congressional funding that they will, I think the word was, not be able to fund any further sod treatments. Is that a fair statement? So that's a little bit scary. I don't know if that's a shot across the bow for the federal budget process. I don't know if it's a scare tactic or if it is in fact reality, but it is pretty darn scary because BLM provides a significant amount of funding to ODF for the treatment of that. So we're aggressively working with our congressional delegation to see that. I might say that I was a forester for Department of Forestry for 34 years, so I'm fairly familiar with conifer species. EU1 scares me to death because it does affect conifer species, our state tree. And the department is aggressively going after EU1. You've provided some funding for EU1, and it is really scary because if it gets into the conifer species in a great way and starts moving north and east over into our timberlands, it could have a significant impact on our economy in the state of Oregon. I'm not trying to be overly, I'm really scared about it. Also, the NA1 strain, which is the one that affects, you know, rhododendrons and tan oaks and those kind of things, I think the prediction is that if nothing happens with the containment of EU1, it will be in Coos County in either 8 or 10 years?
Between 10 and 12.
Okay, between 10
E1
and 12.
Or years. Anyone?
This is the NA1.
Okay.
And what the director's talked to you about is the funding for EU1, the conifer species. The in my opinion, as chair of the task force, or not chair of the task force, excuse me, the facilitator of the task force, I'm also very concerned about the spread of NA1. It is likely to continue spreading. The goal of the task force, and I'm speaking for the task force, unanimously is recommending to contain NA1 from spreading further north into Coos County and potentially spreading east. So there is lack of funding for that. So.
Representative Esquivel, then I'll come back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is kind of like a movie that I've seen before because I believe the chair and I were on a committee that heard this maybe 10, 12 years ago.
NA1.
And at that time, we were supposedly have buffer zones and take care of it. Well, obviously, we didn't get it taken care of, which is hard to do to take put the genie back in the bottle. I would suggest that this committee forward a recommendation not to do a minimum, but to do a maximum. Because if we'd have done this 10 years ago, we were talking $150,000, $250,000. Now we're talking millions. Plus, we're talking the potential to literally erupt the economy of this state when it comes to wood products. Because now you're getting into the Doug fir, you're getting into the white fir, you're getting into the noble fir. So I would suggest, Mr. Chair, that we forward a recommendation to do this correctly and do it right. But more importantly, to even go so far as to say that buffer zone isn't big enough, you need to go farther.
Yeah, I'll come back to you, Representative Smith, in a second. Let's go through the numbers real quick because I want to make sure, I mean, we're amateurs here. But so you said in the beginning phase we found a certain amount. I can't remember how many, but last year was what I was worried about. We found more, we went further, and then this year we found more and went further. Yeah, okay, let's go through this again.
Can you pull up the slide with regards to the expansion of the EU1?
Okay.
It was 1 in 15, 30, I believe, in 16, and now 126 possible.
Yeah. So what makes me nervous
Sarah's
is
slide.
From...
Sarah's slide. Excuse me. Yeah, let me get to her presentation.
Yeah, so do 13, 15, and what we think we're at in 17 again, if you would.
That's 17, I think, isn't it, Sarah?
Yes, so this is where we're at in 17. So you can see the green dots are Those are the 126 infected trees, including Grand Fir and Douglas Fir. These trees that we're sampling, they present differently than the NA1 trees that we typically see infected. Mm-hmm. In these EU1 trees, we're actually sampling symptomatic foliage on the ground, and we're not seeing those characteristic stem girdling cankers. And so they are green trees that have produced spores in the spring and have infected the tan oak foliage near the ground, and so that's what we're picking up. So these are not all red and dead trees on the landscape. We are detecting them at an earlier point in infestation.
So the 20, go back, start from 2013. We had one tree.
We have one tree in 2015.
2015. We had one tree, and we did 13 acres.
We did 13 acres, which equates to a 600-foot buffer.
Okay. Then 2015, we had 30.
We had 25 trees.
25 trees, and we did
how many? 51-acre buffer treatment.
And that wasn't enough, because now we're at 100 and some trees, mm-hmm. four times the number. And we're talking about doing how many? 600?
A 600-foot buffer.
600-foot buffer. So how many acres was it?
It has the potential to be 400 acres.
Yeah, 400 acres. And those little purple circles, those are the treatment
those
areas?
Those are past treatments in 2015. So you can see the single tree was 13 acres, and then there was another treatment in the area of a 10-acre treatment of NA1 trees.
Oh, okay, so it's both kinds.
Mm-hmm.
But potentially from the one purple, these other greens occurred?
I think that the greens were not just an effect of the one purple. I think the one purple was detected before the 2016 trees, and that they potentially were there as well at the same time. But just they do not present as these red trees that that we pick up on the landscape to then go survey.
So I think the point, Representative Esquivel, is you're right, I'm not sure 400 acres is even enough. And I do think you're right, we need to send the message to our emergency board that this is not something to just do as much as we think we hopefully need. We need to go at it full bore. Because you're right, we did talk about NA1 10 years ago, and we did put in money. I remember sitting through maybe $1 million thing in natural resources sub to treat it then, but it clearly wasn't enough. And I think what we'd heard at the time was California already gave up. They're just not even going to try anymore. And lucky for them, they had a big enough population that their nursery market could largely just sell to itself. But we're still trying to export all around the country, so we didn't want to just give up. But now it sounds like we, to some extent, are giving up on eradication on NA1 and going more for managing it the best we can, which at the time I remember thinking, why would they ever just give up? And now that we're in that spot where I guess I get it, it just gets too expensive to redo it. But. So, sorry, Representative Brock-Smith.
No, thank you, Chair Clem, for clarifying all of that. And another thing that you heard there with that Q&A was it's difficult, you know, the foresters and the forest pathologists and Sarah do an excellent job at finding the EU1 strains, but even then some are missed. They do catchment in streams, I know, to catch some spores and other treatments and now foliage on the forest floor. When it comes to the funding issue that Commissioner Labhart was mentioning, once a commissioner, always a commissioner, sir, mentioning before, we're focusing all the funding that we have, and we've discussed that it's not enough, on the EU1, which leaves no funding, essentially, to manage the other portion of the task force recommendations of the NA1 and allowing it to spread. And you have on your packet of information this map, and the red, of course, area is the CHEDCO fire. And so you can see where that was as an overlay. With the BLM uncertainty and their funding, and they have been a fantastic partner in all of this. Whenever they find, you can see the checkerboard patterns of BLM property near the what this area down here in the red coordinated off area. That's what we call the general infested area, where no more treatment is being done. You're in a situation where BLM is, of course, very aggressive in their treatment, and not having the funding to do so would be devastating, because they have been partnering with ODF in a lot of resources. The E-Board funding, and it was also mentioned, of course, that what the EU1 and the NA1 could do to the state's economy. We're working on what those dollars would be, but I have said before that it is in the billions of loss to this state's economy. And then lastly, the E-Board funding is critical, but it's too late. We're talking, in my opinion, because the rains, this pathogen will be spreading this winter. It's already begun with the rains that are putting out these fires. And the funding that we need is necessary now. It was necessary in the session. And we need it in order to aggressively go after the EU1 strain and stop the spread of one tree, 25 trees, and now 126 potential trees now. And so I appreciate the idea of sending a recommendation. I'd be happy to help pin such a recommendation letter for this committee to sign. And I feel, and I'm a little close to this because it's in my district, and it's a task force that we created, and I know how much work Sarah and others have done on this, but I find no other threat greater to this state's economy with regards to our timber resources than this right here.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Chair. Didn't we just have a few trees back 10 years ago, 12 years ago, that were in Oregon, but the majority of them were in California?
Yeah, California was like overrun. It had given up, and then we had a few that one or two nurseries were being affected by on their sales, but that was it. So we were worried, because I think South Carolina or somebody talked the feds into quarantining all of our nursery products for a little while until we proved that not all of them were affected. And then we finally, OAN and others, helped get that fixed. But we thought we had it nailed with, I think, $1 million or something in treatment, and obviously it didn't work.
But what I'm leading up to, we've had this problem for quite some time. We have yet to take care of the problem, and hopefully we can at least contain it to this area. I'm not sure what we can do at this point, but, you know, if you have to spend $10 million or $20 million, so what?
Trying to figure out when the
because the potential is not millions, but billions.
My understanding is we aren't having an E-board until.
So I'm just looking up.
Not scheduled.
Yeah, we had one in July, maybe to December.
And that's a problem. But Representative Esquivel, and I think you were going to say, Sarah, that sod, the NA1 sod is not in Del Norte County, has not been detected in Del Norte County south of Curry County. And then it's Humboldt County.
It's in Humboldt County as well as Trinity County. Mm-hmm. And then there are 13 other counties quarantined in California. And one thing to note is those quarantines are whole county quarantines as opposed to our partial county quarantine in Oregon that is recognized by APHIS because of the eradication treatments that we are conducting in the forest.
And I just want to add, if I may, Mr. Chair, you can see the top quarantine boundary. And thank you, Sarah, because it is unique, and I appreciate Oregon Department of Agriculture's work on that. It is unique to have a partial county quarantine. My understanding is once that treatment
or once the sod reaches the Rogue River, which under current management practices will probably occur within the next 5 years, Curry County entirely will be quarantined. And then you have, once you have a county quarantine area with regards to international trade, you have issues with adjacent counties in quarantine, which would include Coos, Douglas, and Josephine.
Yeah, that's a domino, probably. Yeah. So, Peter, this $400,000 to $500,000, does that include BLM coming up with their money? Is it more if they don't?
Chair Clem, yes. The gap is $431,000 if the BLM comes up with, they were going to contribute $328,000. So that puts it at, we can get you the exact number, but yeah, it puts it around $760,000 gap if the BLM doesn't come through with their funding.
I can tell you, Mr. Chair, that I have had conversations since the governor has been down, visiting the Chetco fire. In essence, we've, the original ask in the bill was $695,000. We met that in essence with the funding that was piecemeal $250,000 and the $450,000 and I have asked her for the additional $1 million to come to the recommendation of the task force and in the strategic plan so that we can have the resources to not only, because you must remember what we're talking about here is the treatment just for the EU one.
Yeah, right.
But there's still the NA one that continues to spread. And so those dollars are necessary as well because you need both fronts being worked at the same time.
So we should figure out what else is out there besides the E-Board. I mean, the governor has a strategic reserve fund. This is not the normal use for that, but who knows? I'm going to probably make somebody angry by saying this, but we collect revenues already that go out to places like my alma mater, Oregon State, for research that has, you know, harvest tax money that goes there. But we probably ought to look at every dollar that comes in that's related to forestry in particular, but figure out what pots of money exist for dealing with problems. We obviously are about to overspend heavily, I'm sure, on our fire fund. So that's not a place to go looking, but we should figure out where the money is. Representative Barreto.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Sarah, you mentioned that you thought that this started from a nursery down there, that a tree came in. So did this tree come from California in these two counties down there that are affected, or do you have an idea of where this came in? And then how hard is this disease to detect on nursery stock if it comes in from other areas? Because if we put this out right now and then 5 years later we get another nursery stock coming in from somewhere else that just brings it right back in again, we're back to square one.
Chair Clem, Representative, I previously, before I worked for the Oregon Department of Forestry, I worked in the Phytophthora Moram program in nurseries for the Oregon Department of Agriculture. And so there, they do have a robust sampling and detection program in nurseries in Oregon for Phytophthora Moram. They have nurseries that are under certain regulations and are surveyed twice a year for this disease, and they have to undergo certain cleanup protocols if it is found, and they do have to notify pre-notify other states if they ship to them as well. And so there is a robust program for our nursery system because it is a contained system. Phytophthora moram is more easily eradicated in nurseries than in forests. And we do know our original 2001 infestation in the city of Brookings that brought sun gnat death was most likely California nursery stock, as well as another introduction in 2013 in the Cape Sebastian area. We do not know if the nursery stock from the nursery near the Pistol River was from California or not. We can't get that deep down to the molecular level there, but we do know the nursery is most likely the probable source for our EU1 infestation in forests.
Thank you.
And that nursery is closed now.
Right, she mentioned that.
Okay, well, we're way over time, I know, but this is pretty important, so let's just take another question or two. Representative McEwen.
I'm not sure I have another question, but Representative Barreto opened a door to something I've been sitting here thinking about, and that is, I know that Ms. Hansen's in the audience today, and the Department of Ag has been involved in this, in the program that you're talking about. We have two parallel things going on. One's nursery stock. One is the potential danger to our timber industry. How are you working with the Department of Ag to make sure that there's a coordinated effort here?
Chair Clem, Representative McEwen, we've been coordinated with the Department of Agriculture from the outset of the disease. The Department of Agriculture is responsible for setting the quarantine on any invasive species, and we've worked closely. We have a memorandum of understanding. We do the forestry treatment. The actual eradication and the authority is under the Department of Ag, and so we coordinate closely to do the treatments in forestry. They handle the nursery side, and it's been a great partnership. The one time they do get involved in forestry is when we have a landowner that is unwilling to allow us to treat lands, then we would have to get a court order to force treatment. But that's the only time. They've been partners all along. They serve on the core science team. So has a U.S. Forest Service and the BLM. So it's been a great partnership through the very initiation and discovery of sudden oak death.
Thank you.
Okay. We're going to move on to a different invasive species issue, but thanks for coming. And
thank you all.
Okay, can I have Alexis and Clint Burford come up? Because you can bring whoever else you want, but that's the names I've got on my little cheat sheet here. We're going to talk about first invasive Japanese beetle.
Great.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, thank you for having us today. For the record, my name is Alexis Taylor. I'm director of the Oregon Department of Agriculture. With me, I have Clint Burfitt, who is the Insect Pest Prevention Management Program Manager, IPPM. You'll see why we use that acronym. It's a mouthful to say that program. I actually think the conversation you were having, started by Representative Esquivel, is really timely for and a lead-in to this conversation today around the Japanese beetle and the eradication program we have undertaken last year up in the North Portland area. This is a genie that is in the bottle today, and we really have the ability to keep it there with a lot of hard work, and we started that hard work in the support of the legislature as well. We're very lucky to have Clint on our staff at ODA. He comes to us from Utah and has successfully ran an eradication program for the Japanese beetle. He has proven that it can be done, and so we feel very lucky to have him leading our effort at the department. So why do we care about the Japanese beetle in Oregon? Well, first and foremost, they like to eat what we eat. In Oregon, we grow what we eat, and they like to eat what we grow. The Japanese beetle is established in pretty much every state east of the Rockies, and it is established in no state west of the Rockies. So the fact that we have discovered it in Oregon, we're really on the first line of defense to ensuring that it does not become established west of the Rockies. We have that natural barrier that it's not going to naturally migrate here. So when it comes over, we find a population of it. Being targeted, being aggressive, I think is vital, but also, we can be successful if we do those things. Also, we care because it's going to have a huge economic impact to our state if we allow it to become established here in Oregon. Our estimates are it will cost us $43 million a year annually if it becomes established here. That will be on quarantine and also additional pesticide uses. Clint will kind of go over more conversation in greater detail on what has happened and what we are looking to do going forward. But I think one key part in this slide kind of articulates that is the community engagement that we've done has been a key part. We have worked with the community, the city, the county, the state, the legislature, and non-governmental organizations in Oregon as well, really to make this a successful program in the first year. I think that partnership has been key to the success and will be key continuing to go forward. With that, I will turn it over to Clint to talk a little bit more about what we've done and where we think this is going to go.
Great. Thank you, Director Taylor. Chair Clem, I'd like permission to bring a display up.
Sure.
This display was created from plants and beetles collected from the Cedar Mill Japanese beetle infestation in 2016. When we found this infestation last August, we had roughly 8 months to put together an eradication plan. And so, unbeknownst to the Japanese beetles that were developing in the soil, we were able to begin eradication last April. And it was quite literally all hands on deck. As you can see here, a couple of our chief entomologists and Director Taylor in the field. Overall, we had 2,121 properties that were treated beginning the third week of April and ending in the last week of May. In addition to treatment, we were also able to increase our traps statewide from roughly 3,500 in 2016 to 7,500 in 2017, or 7,271. The traps in Cedar Mill was roughly 2,069, so these are high-density surveillance areas, and then we also put roughly 1,000 traps out at the airport. As of last week, we're roughly 15,600 beetles. The majority of those are coming out of 9 traps in the center of our treatment area. We had 10 beetles detected at PDX. These are beetles that come off of air cargo, FedEx, and then we also had 5 beetles at Swan Island. These were detected at the FedEx facility, ground transportation facility. We also found 10 beetles in Oakland in central southern Oregon. And we've been interviewing neighbors there, and it looks like these likely came in on potted plants from Arkansas. So you can see the variety of different ways that this particular invasive species is brought to Oregon. This is a map of the locations of the beetles that we found this year. So this is Highway 26. This is Cedar Mill. This is an unincorporated section of Washington County. And this is the Multnomah, Washington County line here. Forest Park is over here. Forest Park Heights is over here. Bethany, Oak Hills. So you can see that the traps that just have the gray outline, those are traps that have not detected beetles. So we still have many traps within our treatment area that have not detected beetles. But you can see that the majority of the beetles are coming out of several traps in what we're now discovering as our epicenter. This is a larger view of the area. So this is Portland International Airport. You can see the beetles are mainly around the air cargo section on the west side of the airport, Swan Island, and then the Cedar Mill area. One thing that I'd like to draw your attention to is this cluster over here in Hillsboro. Part of the project was to contain the spread of Japanese beetle from the movement of yard debris. And so we diverted roughly 2,000 tons of yard debris from this area to deep burial into Hillsboro landfill. Part of that process was having an option for landscapers to drop off the yard debris collected within the infestation over at a drop-off site. So that is accounted for the beetles there. And it also proves the fact that this is being vectored or has a great potential to be vectored through the movement of that type of material.
I have a question.
Representative McKeon.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. So when you have those landscapers move that debris to a set point, do you burn that? I mean, it seems to me that that may be an opportunity to spread this pathogen, this bug, as opposed to eradicate it. How is that dealt with?
Chair Clem, Representative, the idea is to bury this into the working face of the Hillsboro landfill.
Okay.
So what was happening before was this debris was going to compost operations that don't monitor or control moisture content, which means that they don't get hot enough to destroy Japanese beetle life stages. So we decided to divert this high-risk material to deep burial.
And that creates the temperature that you need to eradicate it then?
That basically just traps the bee.
Because you're smothering it.
That's correct.
Okay. All right, thank you.
No problem. This shows the number of Japanese beetles detected per day. So a couple different stories here is in 2008, my predecessor, Dr. Helmut Rogge, along with an entrepreneur, put together a novel approach for monitoring Japanese beetles at the airport. The problem was we had Japanese beetles coming in at the airport, and we were finding them there, and that made it so that we had to treat the airport every year. But because they were able to put together what we call a photo trap, so this is basically a cellular phone unit that takes a photo of the trap every day, we were able to get those freshly detected beetles into a type of analysis which showed that these beetles that we're detecting at the airport are not from Oregon. And then now we've utilized this technology to show us what the population is doing over time. So you can see we caught our first beetle on June 18th. We had peak emergence at roughly 500 beetles per day coming in at these photo traps on July 9th, and then it slopes off. And this information will help us target the treatment for this next year. This is a photo of our containment site at Northwest Landscaping Services. You can see the landscapers are dropping off debris here, and then it's hauled off in these containers for deep burial. We've also done a biological control project. We've tried to prove up the concept that we can initiate classical biological control at high-risk sites, airports and nurseries in the areas of the country where it's infested. So we worked with another entomologist this year back east who was able to go to historic establishment sites and develop the proof of concept that these things can establish. And next year, we're going to be working with OSU to look at what rate do these parasitoids attack the Japanese beetle. We've also provided Japanese beetles to screen for another fungal pathogen to see if there's a fungal pathogen biocontrol for this. Our current efforts right now is communications, and we've got a strategic communications framework that's in draft form right now. Our next step is to be able to get that to our Japanese beetle partners briefing in October, where we can have a wide variety of community partners provide input on this. And an example of how our community, our Japanese beetle partners helped this project last year was when Oregon Association of Nurseries convened other agricultural industries, and that actually resulted in the Oregon Association of Nurseries providing funding for this project. So what's next? Right now, we still have some traps out, so we're analyzing the project results, finalize our 2018 response plan, communications framework draft. We're on target, I believe, by the middle of October to have that ready. Japanese beetle facilitated briefing, the 26th of October, it'll be in Washington County. We're planning on getting a gratitude letter out to our community and our partners. This project wouldn't have been possible if it wasn't for all the grassroots support that we received. Okay. And then begin our education component. In November, my counterpart and I from California Department of Agriculture organized a symposium at the Entomological Society of America on the westward expansion of Japanese beetle, and this will serve as a science review of our current protocol. We'll have all of the national and international experts on this species together to provide us input. Our direct engagement with the community begins in January, open house informational meetings in February, and then we also continue direct engagement with the community to get consent to treat properties in February. And then April, our communications around treatment begin, and then containment communications begin in May. So in conclusion of this part of the presentation, I'd like to just finish with a story. In 2006, in Orem, Utah, a master gardener brought us in a Japanese beetle. We went back out at a similar time, put out 100 traps every 1,000 feet around that, and we recovered 600 beetles that year. The next year, we put out a lot more traps, similar to what we did here, and we recovered roughly 3,000 beetles. And by 2012, we had brought that down to zero. So in my experience, I know that when the community and governments like state government or the Oregon Invasive Species Council work with our agricultural industry partners like the Oregon wine growers, Oregon Association of Nurseries, the Blueberry Commission, that we can provide solutions to complex problems.
Vice Chair McLean?
You mentioned, you know, the lawn debris and the whole idea of that's, you know, a place where they get moved or they can get captured and you need to get rid of it or deep bury it. But are you doing education with folks who do landscaping? Is that part of your outreach?
Yeah, Chair Clem, Representative, we did quite a bit of outreach. We gave all of the landowners a translated copy of the information so that they could give that to their landscapers. We also canvassed the area, and then we've been working with the landscaping associations in the area. It proves to be a challenge to get the word out to all the landscapers in the area, so we'll continue that next year.
Mm-hmm. Brock Smith.
Thank you. And thanks for your work on this. And Alexis, thank you for all your work on sod as well. How much has been spent as far as resources on this project of eradication since its beginning?
Chair Clem, Representative Brock Smith, I'm going to ask Lauren Henderson, the Assistant Director, to come up and speak to that.
For the record, Lauren Henderson, I'm the Assistant Director with the Department of Ag. Chair Clem, Representative Brock Smith, as you can imagine, it's not cheap. Our preliminary budget estimates for this last effort were in the $2 million range for the 17-19 biennium. We did get almost $1.3 million in lottery dollars through the budget process this last session. We're just now wrapping up what the effort really was, because it was estimates, and that will dictate going forward where we're at. I think Clint can help me a little bit with this, but this is not a tomorrow project. This is probably 5 or 6 years of being very vigilant, not unlike any other invasive species project we do. So I'm going to make some estimates here that it's $1 million at least a year. Part of the expense that we were not expecting was what Clint described with that, the landscaping debris and hauling that off and quarantining it. That is a very expensive process, and I think our estimates there were about $500,000 to do that. But you can see, if you don't do that, as you pointed out, Vice Chair McLean and Representative McEwen, you just spread it all over the place. So that's not what we want, obviously. So we'll have some better estimates that I think we can bring back, certainly in the next session or February for folks, and we'll work with legislative fiscal on those numbers.
Thank you.
Okay. So Alexis and Lauren, you may want to stay, right, for the next one, but thank you, Clint, for joining us. And then did you want to bring up Lisa?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And let me just give a little preview of this from my perspective. In 2015, there was a variety of bills that all got assembled under the leadership of Chair Witt to a package of different ways to get at some of the challenges that people in Oregon were facing around aerial spraying. And we put quite a bit of money, raised quite a bit of fees, and I wanted to have the department tell us how that's been working in terms of people who said that, you know, we couldn't get inspectors out there fast enough, and so they would, you know, suspect something happened, and then somebody couldn't get out there for a couple of weeks, and they thought it had already washed off by then. And so we worked pretty hard in this committee and some other work groups to come up with some solutions, and I wanted us to get an update on that. And I don't know, Representative Witt, do you want to make any comments? You were in charge of that whole effort. And
just be interested in seeing their report.
Yeah, okay, great.
Great. Thank you, Chair Clem, members of the committee. For the record, Alexis Taylor, Director of the Oregon Department of Agriculture. With me today, I have Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director, and Lauren Henderson, Assistant Director. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about this, I think, important piece of the department's mission, one that we take very seriously, and really be able to talk about what ODA has done with the additional resources and authorities that came about in the 2015 legislative session. So a little bit about what we'll cover is up there today. I wasn't here in 2015, but I have had conversation with staff, with party, with our stakeholders, with interested parties in the state on the discussion that was going on in 2015. And I understand there was obviously significant discussion at that time around pesticide application and, Chair Clem, as you mentioned, aerial application of pesticides, around a significant event, a pesticide incident and investigation in the state's response at that time. Today we will cover kind of what has evolved out of that 2015 legislative session. I think a good place to start is, what is a pesticide? And I think a picture says a thousand words. Pesticide means it's a big, broad, general term that covers a host of products that are really used to destroy, prevent, repel, or mitigate a pest. They are things like insecticides and herbicides, terms that we use every day. This is just showing kind of the pyramid of regulation that we use in the state of Oregon and with our federal partners on how we regulate and enforce the pesticide laws. ODA is a state lead, is a lead agency for Oregon under ORS 634, which is our state law. In the center, we have a cooperative agreement with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, who has the federal law, FIFRA, which is the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act. We jointly enforce that through that cooperative agreement, our state laws, but also then the federal laws. One thing I will say is recently, during recent reviews, EPA has been complimentary of our enforcement activities around the pesticide program. And we are continually striving for improvements in what we do in speeding up response times, improve communications with citizens and interested parties, and much of that came about as a result of the 2015 legislative session. So part of a House Bill 3549 was aerial applicator licensing. This was a new requirement. Previously, there was no aerial applicator license. It was just kind of an endorsement on the commercial applicator's license. And you can see some of the requirements that are part of an aerial applicator getting a pesticides aerial application license. I think that last bullet also speaks to, we really look at this as an ongoing process with aerial applicators to continue technical education with them throughout the course of the year. Currently, we have 92 active license holders in the state, and an aerial application license is certified for 5 years, but they do have to come and renew that license and pay that fee every year. Also part of House Bill 3549 was an aerial application applicator exam. We began offering this exam last summer. This was a new requirement for the 2017 license year, which we're in today, and our license year run from January to December. We currently have 22 proctored testing locations across the state for aerial applicators who want to take this exam, and as you can see, we have a very high success rate. 3549 also made changes to our enforcement authorities. Obviously, you can see up there our civil penalties doubled, but it also gave us some clearer and specific authority around suspending or revoking a license if a licensee did not pay their civil penalty, but also the ability to retest if we thought there was inadequate knowledge or there was indications of inadequate knowledge around Oregon pesticide laws. We'll talk a little bit about what 3549 brought around the park, the Pesticide Analytical and Response Center, but I wanted to show who is part of PARC and give a little bit of history on what PARC is. So this slide kind of shows all the interested agencies in PARC. The PARC coordinator is housed at ODA. Our PARC coordinator, Ted Bunch, is here with me today.
Ted, raise your hand.
Yeah. PARC was actually established in 1978. The purpose was to collect, coordinate, and analyze information about reported incidents that may affect human, environment, and animal health. It's an interagency coordinated team. They, as I said, they collect and analyze information. Everyone responds based upon their different authorities, whether it's ODA or the Oregon Health Authority. But they also importantly work to identify trends that we may be seeing around pesticide incidences. So 3549 and the 2005 budget package that also passed during that legislative session made a couple changes in additions to PARC, which I think are really important to how we carry out our mission at ODA today. First, it directed, and each member agency of PARC of that last slide have brought about and cemented standard operating procedures. So how do we, when we get an incident reported to us, how do we communicate, how fast do we organize, and then each agency's how they operate and how do we talk together. I think that's a really important part that we have written those all down. It also brought about a citizen advocate and liaison. This has really helped, that was part of the budget package, but that really has helped how we communicate with the general public, our outreach to individuals who have been affected or potentially affected by a pesticide incident. And also they serve as our liaison on the Environmental Justice Task Force. So that's a really key part and takeaway, I think, from what happened in 2015 for the department. And, you know, really we look at that as how do we connect with every Oregonian and every interested citizen out there. It also brought about, I think, one of the concerns we heard around the conversation in 2015 is how do we connect to the department outside of normal business hours? And that's where 211 really came about. It started in February of 2016. And really that response to having a central point of contact 24/7 to report an incident if an Oregonian believes they've been impacted. So we're completed our first year, for which really ran under 211 of February 16 to March 2017. This is what that first year snapshot looks like. We've had 144 phone calls. Four were pesticide-related incidences. 85 were related to the gypsy moth eradication in Portland that we did. And of those 144, 49 were outside of normal business hours. So there was clearly a need to contact the department outside of our normal kind of 8 to 5 working hours. I think one of the interesting things that we see, and I think the gypsy moth 85 phone calls there really indicate, is this came about around pesticide use, but I think it's much broader for the whole department, and a benefit, I think, for Oregonians contacting the department and a whole host of things that we do. House Bill 3549 also directed the department to provide information on to the public on restricted use pesticides. We had this available prior, but it was not in a very user-friendly way. It was not regularly updated. I think it was, you know, kind of cumbersome. And so here are screenshots of what it looks like today. I think another important addition that came about because of the 2015 legislative session is we say why something is restricted use. And that was not up there before. So just providing more information to Oregonians who have an interest on what's restricted use and what is not, and maybe why. Currently, we have just under 500 restricted use pesticides registered in the state. As Chair Clem mentioned, we made some additions or some changes to the fee structure. You can see currently, we have the authority to go up to $400 for a registration of a product. We're currently at $320. That was done in 3549. Also, part of the 2015 legislative session in the budget package, we got additional staff resources, which I think have been critical. We got four new investigators and one case reviewer. I think one lesson we took out of the incident in 2015 of an aerial applicator, it was on forest lands, is that we didn't have a very strong background at ODA in forestry. And so in those four additional investigators, we were able to bring on one investigator with a strong background in the forest industry. So that's been helpful. And actually, since then, since I've been hired, we've hired another investigator with a forestry background. So I think we took that as a lesson learned, and I think that's been beneficial. We also updated our database, and I asked my staff, I was like, well, what does that mean and why is that important? It's allowed us to build better case files, to track more information, and then to really be able to mine data better, to be able to tell what's going on out there, but then also be able to, as we're doing an investigation, building a case file, actually have a solid base of evidence for that. We have been able to increase routine inspections and our observations on ag use observations, which is not just on ag, it's also on forestry and aerial applications, has increased by 50%. I think that's really important. That's outreach on the front end. There's a multiplier effect, being able to head off a potential problem before it starts. So I think that's been vital to working with the industry to make sure we don't come into a problem. Some of the other things we've been doing around records, we've increased our dealer record reviews by 18%, increased our applicator record reviews by 17%, and our marketplace inspections by 41%. And then finally, on that last bullet, we took on a new crop, and that new crop is cannabis as a regulated commodity for the pesticide program. And I think that's important to note here, because while the additional resources and authorities did not come about, it came at a really important time, I think, in cannabis regulation. I'll just be very blunt. I think the department would be underwater in our pesticide investigations without those additional resources. So I think it has been an added benefit to the department to continue to carry out that critical mission.
So let's pause on that then for a moment. So not that you said it quite this directly, but what I'm also reading into it is pesticide application, the right term would be pesticide registrants who paid this increased fee are a lot of their funds are going to deal with cannabis-related things. And the question is, do cannabis-related registrations cover costs, or are those of us who are buying pesticides for other things subsidizing cannabis-related activities?
Well, so cannabis does not have any EPA-approved pesticides because it's still federally
illegal. Yeah.
So there aren't any registered products for any
fee to be collected against.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, that seems like a problem. So I'm glad you identified that. I don't know if we still have our joint committee, but if it's gone, then and our former chair and expert is now a judge, so maybe we'll start taking over more of that, unfortunately, here. But that's something that I think needs attention, because certainly if it's going to be legal, we want it safe and clean, but the industry is making plenty of money and needs to pay for that. Not everybody else pay so they can have a regulatory scheme to keep their product safe that other people are paying for. So we'll need to work on that.
Can I just,
Vice Chair McClain?
My understanding is they can't use pesticides. Is that true?
So we have developed, Chair Clem, Vice Chair McClain, we developed a process and a guide list of about 300 products that they are approved to use.
Okay.
But these are not, so they're registered for other purposes, and I don't believe any restricted use. Correct. Pesticide.
Okay, thank you.
For the record, Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Department, if I might add. So our guide list has very low-risk products. They aren't the traditional chemistries necessarily that you would think of. Mm-hmm. Things like peppermint oil, okay. garlic oil that are used in organic production okay, yeah. typically are on that list.
Yeah. All right, thank you.
So do you get any revenues from the taxation that occurs on cannabis to help? I don't even remember who all collects it, if it's OLCC only or who. But
so, Chair Clem, the only revenue that we're currently getting is for our cannabis coordinator. We do get that transfer. It's about $250,000. We have brought this issue up to the committee as well as our budget committee. Representative Witt, I think, has heard that from me particularly several times. And I wanted to just add one component. The funding that was added as part of 3549 also had a laboratory enhancement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And laboratory costs, you have to add that to this discussion, mm-hmm. Not only on the pesticide issues, but also on the cannabis, because there's a whole laboratory testing scheme that OHA and OLCC and us have related to this. And so we will see most likely increased costs in our laboratory related to that, too. So it's the program. When you talk about the increased costs, you have to add the lab costs to that. Cannabis is very hard on laboratory equipment. And so we were able to add laboratory equipment because of the resources right, here. Yeah. But now that's having to be used for something that we hadn't planned on. And so there needs to be some thought to that as well.
Hey. Yeah, it's not exciting. So there wasn't a separate lab when we said potency or whatever needs to be tested. It's using these existing labs. Yep. Nothing new was funded and created just for that industry.
Chair Clem, the private labs are doing the market testing.
Yeah.
But when we have to do our investigations and part of our process for that, we then go into our investigatory process, which includes lab testing.
Okay, I see. All right. Okay. Sorry to interrupt, but that's an important point.
Yes, sir. So this is just a picture, says 1,000 words. Where are our staff? You'll see where our investigators are throughout the state. And you'll see the majority of them are in District 1 and 2, and that's because the vast majority of our cases are in those districts in the Willamette Valley. So opportunities for continuous improvement. I think we at ODA are committed to kind of that continual improvement and taking lessons and really learning from them when issues arise and maybe we weren't fully prepared for, constantly reviewing our standard operating procedures at ODA within PARC and then with our sister agencies. I think our citizen advocate has been vital to this effort of continuous improvement and how we outreach and communicate with the public and with concerned and interested citizens. I think one area that we have identified and we are working on today is the reporting of incidences into 211. I think it's not necessarily well known across the state or even within state government. PARC works. I've seen it firsthand, but it only works when the incidence is reported into PARC. I think one area that we have seen this in is with the Coos Bay Children's Academy. Mm-hmm. When our staff became aware of it, they instantly notified PARC, and we started that process and concluded that investigation and went through all that. It worked, but making sure that our partners with the Oregon Health Authority and their partners of healthcare providers, working with the Department of Education and their facilities, working with our sister agencies across state government, we're doing a lot of creation of material for those different buckets of people and outreach to them. I sent a email with a memo to all my counterparts across state government saying, here's PARC. this is what it does. Here's how you can report a pesticide incident. Please share this with all your staff, because as Oregonians, I think we all have a responsibility to make sure that this is known, and people who become affected from or potentially affected from a pesticide incident know how they could potentially report it, and that includes healthcare providers, daycares, those types of things. So I think we really are looking at this model of continuous improvement. We constantly want to be communicating with individuals better, quicker, and make sure our response time is appropriate. And so I think we're constantly taking lessons learned and building on them on how we can continue to improve what we do every day. I think with that, I'll just conclude to say that I've really seen firsthand the commitment of the Department of Agriculture staff to be fair, transparent, responsive, timely, fact-based, objective in the work that they do in this program. The enhanced resources and the additional authorities that came about in 2015 have been vital for us to continue that vital mission that serves our regulated community, but also every single Oregonian who lives in the state. So with that, Chair Clem, members of the committee, thank you for the time to be here, and we're happy to take any additional questions you might have.
So before we go into general questions, I want to make a comment about that Coos Bay Academy, because it was an interesting way for me to see how an issue that came up, maybe 08 or 09, there was a bunch of interest in aerial spray related things around farms, and we convened a work group schools and farms, and now Congresswoman Bonamici and I convened a group. And the Oregon Environmental Council had done a study and said, actually, the biggest risk is teachers not knowing what they're doing and setting off traps. And it's not as big a problem as you might think it is for nearby farms compared to the educators who aren't pesticide people, who are just trying to take care of a problem as cheaply as possible. And so we created this whole program, integrated pest management and coordinators at all these public schools. And then when I saw the report from Park, I read, and sure enough, it was a employee who's not a licensed pesticide applicator thinking they knew what they were doing. And that was exactly what OEC's survey had said. And I think we've largely solved a lot of that in the public schools that are covered under the IPM law, but these private academies and facilities weren't covered. So we can do our best to model best practices and let them know that there are IPM programs, but certainly you should be using licensed applicators and not just figuring out for yourself what seems like a good way to deal with a pest, because your role is to teach kids and not have to hopefully clean up your classroom of rodents or whatever. But in some cases, I guess they wear two hats, and that's part of the problem. But it was an interesting thing for me to see that an original problem got solved in a slightly different way than we thought. And for the most part, we haven't heard about that issue in the public schools anymore. But that was a big thing at one time. I'm sorry, Rep. McEwen.
Thank you, Chair Clem. I was actually involved in the school district in a board capacity when that was designed. And so we were looking at it from the other side, and it was a really great piece of work. I want to thank Ms. Hansen for keeping me apprised of what was happening with this incident in Coos Bay. We seem to be ground zero for being poster children for many things in where I live. This is one of many, but I'm heartened to hear you say that this communication of the role of PARC needs to be accelerated. I've had conversations with the folks at the county. It's like anything else that's new. We need to keep dripping it in before all of a sudden there's a mindset that it's there. I think our city employees, our county commissioners, our city councils, our school district personnel, it's incumbent upon you to make sure that information continues to get out, because that timely response is critical and very important. Unfortunately, that school no longer exists. I think it was the last straw that kind of created a problem for them, and it was an unfortunate end to how that thing rolled out. But really critical that we keep our children safe and that we provide this information about PARC. And I'm remiss if I don't give a shout out to Representative Representative Witt for his work in 2015. I sat in on those meetings that he held, and you did a masterful job of navigating through a very difficult issue. And I think at the end we came out with very appropriate legislation. And it's nice to hear that these things are they're happening and they're happening well. And when there is things that we can do better, let's continue to do them better. But I think the investments are well made, and we appreciate your work. And thank you again to Representative Witt.
Thank you, Representative.
Chair Witt, I like to call him.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Much of the 2015 effort was based on perceptions for a need for information. Was the Ag Department responsive in a timely fashion? Were pesticide applications exposing humans as well as natural communities to pesticides? And broadly, was there a contamination oftentimes beyond the proposed application site? Was there drift? Were aerial applications consistent with the plans for the application? Were we applying pesticides outside of the planned area as separate and distinct from drift itself? I'm wondering what your findings would be in light of the last couple of years of experience under this reporting. And then I have a follow-up question, Mr. Chairman.
Chair Clem, Representative Witt, thank you for the question. We have had several aerial drift cases since the 2015 legislation. You may remember it's been about a year and a half ago, we had another pretty significant one in which we ended up revoking an aerial applicator's license. And so we've continued to take that very seriously, investigate those in a timely manner, and identify where there are issues and take corrective actions and hold people responsible for their actions as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So we have had a couple of instances, several actually, where I think it would be appropriate to label folks rogue applicators. This led, I think, one could argue, to a concern among members of the public that if helicopters were going over, folks became concerned that they and their children, perhaps their family vegetable garden, were being exposed to harmful pesticides. In light of a couple of years of experience, is the typical applicator, let's say 90 to 95% of the applicators and applications, consistent with state law and rules?
Chair Clem, Representative Witt, I think if we looked at, and we don't have the data, because we don't have a use reporting system, but the data, clearly, in terms of the number of applications that are made, the acres that are treated on an annual basis, we really have a very low incidence of misapplications that we're finding and moving through our system and taking regulatory action against. If you would like clear numbers and data, we can go back and mine that updated database and pull some more of that information out for you. But I don't have numbers right off the top of my head. But when you look at it in whole, in the majority, for the most part, our applicators are doing a pretty good job. We've had the two incidents where we've revoked the licenses. One of those applicators recently had his license reinstated. He's going under additional monitoring by our program so that we can monitor his record keeping and the applications. We're coming upon the time in which that second applicator could apply for his license to be renewed. And we will be looking at what additional steps we need to take to assure that he is appropriately educated and prepared to take that responsibility.
Mr. Chairman, Lisa, your offer is very kind. I would weigh two concerns. One, first, I think that it would be difficult to evaluate the success of the program without that data. That has to be balanced, of course, with the fact that we don't give you, we the legislature don't give you the various departments surplus revenue that I'm aware of. So I would hate to ask for a research project that would cost a considerable amount of money, but were you able to do that on the cheap, I think it would be helpful. I think it would be a means of our evaluating our success of the program or not. An observation, Mr. Chairman. I have not been hearing the complaints that I heard previously about pesticide applications or concern about individuals' habitat, property being contaminated. I'm not hearing that, and that may be suggestive that there is success with this program. But I think we need to find out where the public is at and whether the public has found that level of comfort that I think was driving the need or the perceived need for additional expenditure of money and resources back in 15.
Vice Chair McLean.
First of all, I just wanted to thank you for the update because I was really appreciative. I was here during 2015 in my first session and went through some of those work groups and some of that information. And I felt like the report today was really comforting to see that we're making steps forward, and I really appreciate it. And I do want to say, as far as you don't think teachers need to get training for pesticide removal, I couldn't help myself. But I have to tell you that in my 44 years as a teacher, I had to get training for what to do with blood pathogens, how to give shots to diabetics in my classroom. I had to get a food handler certificate, van training, CPR training. I also had to get information and a test every year on mandatory reporting. And one of the last tests that were given to me was my pesticide training for how to keep pests out of our classroom. So we were getting training on a regular basis.
That's good.
Just good. To let you know.
Rep. Rocksmith.
Yeah, we try to do that too.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you and Lisa. It seems like I don't know. It seems like my district, we're just in the epicenter of you know, sudden oak death, the largest wildfire in the nation, and the 2013 October Cedar Valley incident, which was a driving factor in this work that occurred in 15, and I just happened to be the county commissioner at the time. So, Lisa, I appreciate you and all your work then, and worked with, of course, former Director Koba during this process. My citizens down there were very upset, and I can tell you I don't hear those comments either anymore, Representative Witt. So what I see is the steps that we're taking and the good work done by you, sir, and this committee and the Oregon Department of Agriculture has been a step forward in the process, and I really appreciate it. You know, as I said then in 13, and that applicator broke the law, and we have laws in place to prevent that. He received punishment for that. Maybe not to the extent of some of my residents and how they felt that needed to happen, but nevertheless, laws were strengthened. And I just want to thank you for your work And, of course, again, Representative Witt for yours. So.
Thank you, Representative.
Yeah, one thing that we didn't talk too much, but I think it was, it's probably ODF who's administering it, is another piece of that legislation was the new, or actually restoration of buffers that were, had been in place up through 96 or 98 or something like that. And we don't need a big comment on it. I just wanted to say that there are buffer zones that had once been in effect that weren't, that now are in effect again. And so I think the combination of those heavier fines. Now it's almost, I think from what I heard prior to coming into this, it's basically one day response time or same day response time, license revocations that have occurred, you know, all have sent a message that, that this is definitely a more serious activity. If you're being cavalier with your applications, you're going to have major problems. And that has a self-regulating effect, obviously, not to mention preventative things like buffers.
Mm-hmm. I just wanted to add real quick, Lisa, again, thank you as well, because before I left office down there, I remember, so there were some concerns, there was observers available, and they have been used, which the citizens appreciate, knowing that there's that extra layer of criticism, if you will, that they have. So thank you.
Thank you, and I would just say thank you to all of you. I think there were a lot of lessons learned from Cedar Valley, one of the things I think that you're hearing, because you're not hearing, the department has really focused on communication and communication with affected parties and timely communication, and that customer liaison position has been incredibly helpful to keep us focused on that. You know, we had said multiple times post the Cedar Valley incident, one of our biggest lessons learned was timely communication. Even if we didn't have all of the information, we needed to be able to talk to people about what we knew, mm-hmm. and where we were going, and do that in a more timely manner. And in the past, we had always kind of held back on that until we had a case complete, because we were concerned about the accuracy of the information and preparing the case, you know, if it were to go forward in court. But from all of that, it's very clear. People have a need to know as much as they can in a very timely fashion. And we have taken that job very seriously throughout this process.
Good. And it's very much appreciated.
Okay, final thoughts, and we'll move on to land use. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the 215's efforts to come with a package on pesticides, I had the pleasure of working many, many, many hours with both Lauren and Lisa, and so many hours, in fact, that I think my staff will kill me if I ever went near this subject again. But I will tell you that the professionalism, the dedication, the personal commitment of these two individuals is simply unsurpassed, and they are the epitome of good public servants. So thank you both.
Agreed. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Now we're moving on to land use. And let me ask Andy Shaw, Randy Tucker, and Ben Bryant to join us. Then on deck are Dr. Seltzer and Mildner from PSU. And we might try and we might try and shave off like 5 minutes, and then we'll just shave everybody a few minutes. But we're close to on time anyway.
We'll do our best, Mr. Chair.
You're looking pretty good.
I'm Randy Tucker with Metro, Legislative Affairs Manager. And Andy, what's you?
Andy Shaw, Government Affairs Director at Metro.
Andy and I are going to kind of tag team through what looks like a really long PowerPoint, but a lot of them we're just going to click right through to give you an impression, okay?
Hey, Randy, before you start, I'll tell you why we're doing this. So I have asked in the past Metro to describe to us how they go about calculating land supply, because calculating land supply then leads to, is there a need to expand urban growth boundary or not? And as we debate all these various housing issues, certainly supply and whether the urban growth boundary has been expanded enough is always right in the middle of it. And so I wanted to delve down into, at least in this particular jurisdiction, how they go about calculating land supply, because it's a hot topic of debate and will be, I'm sure, until housing prices go down.
Mr. Chair, I believe you also asked us to give you an update on reserves.
And Sorry.
Urban rural reserves, yeah. And so we're going to do that as quickly as we can.
Awesome.
And we'll get to the land supply questions. Okay, thank you. A little history. Back in the early 2000s, there was a lot of dissatisfaction with the way the urban growth boundary process was working. Metro went through expansions in 2002 and 2004 that ended up being quite contentious, and Representative McLean experienced that firsthand. Under the rules at that time, Metro had to reevaluate the UGB every 5 years. We had to look at basically every acre around the outside of the boundary because there was no such thing as a targeted focus on urban reserves. The farmers were upset because they were always under the microscope, and the development community was unhappy as well because the rules at that time said that we have to look at the worst farmland first, and so that didn't always correspond to the land that was the most appropriate for urban development, most easy to serve with infrastructure, et cetera, and that the market was interested in. And so the result was that we had to expand the urban growth boundary in places that maybe weren't wanted, and we were prevented from expanding the urban growth boundary in the places that made the most sense. After a long regional conversation and a lot of collaboration, Senate Bill 1011 was passed in 2007 to change that process. It authorized Metro to establish urban reserves that were based not so much on where the farmland was the worst, but on what was the most appropriate land for urban development. Meanwhile, it said that if you do that, you also have to establish rural reserves to protect farmland and forest land and other important natural features over the long term to give people some certainty in investing in their agricultural operations, et cetera. You couldn't do one without the other. It was a 40 to 50 year horizon that was established in the legislation. In other words, if the urban reserves were supposed to cover 40 to 50 years worth of land need, the rural reserves were protected from being brought into the urban growth boundary for that same period of time. That responded to the needs of both the agricultural community and the development community. And then in responding to the needs of both Metro and our county partners, nothing could happen except by agreement between Metro and the counties. So we passed that legislation in 2007 and embarked on a long, very collaborative, very broad-based process of trying to actually designate the reserves. And at the end of 2010, there was agreement on maps that were then submitted to LCDC, and those were affirmed by LCDC in 2012.
So as we've testified before to you, there were then multiple appeals to the reserves designation that was made back then. Ultimately, after a lengthy process of review, the Court of Appeals rejected Washington County's portion of the reserves completely, and that led to the grand bargain in the legislature, which not only designated the reserves in Washington County, but also added some land immediately to the urban growth boundary. A chunk of that land was actually land that we had chosen to add to the boundary, and a chunk of it was land that was added out of a settlement process that led to the legislative bill. Multnomah County and Clackamas County also had technical remands in that process, and we were directed to go back and examine specific parcels of land with very specific issues and come back with further evidence about why in Clackamas County an urban reserve was designated in Stafford and why in Multnomah County a rural reserve was designated in a particular area. We began right away to attempt to resolve those questions. Unfortunately, at the time, we had a commission in Clackamas County that just was not interested in resolving the reserves at that time. A new commission was elected, and in 2016, we sat down with the chair and agreed to a process to look back at the reserves and to finish up the process. Within 6 months, even with a lot of contentious issues, we resolved the reserve designations, added findings. We've lost our slides. It's fine. We added findings to the record around the Stafford area. But not only that, the main reason that the Clackamas reserves had been remanded to us were suits by two cities challenging the transportation capability in the Stafford area. At the end of this six-month process of redoing the reserves, we signed an intergovernmental agreement. Oh, good. This is the important picture. We signed an intergovernmental agreement with Clackamas County, Metro, and the three cities surrounding the Stafford area, all agreeing to not only the designation of the urban reserve in that area, but also the process that we would pursue to identify how to build the infrastructure and to govern that area as it is considered to be added to the urban growth boundary, and made it clear that the cities there are going to have to work together to figure out who's going to govern, who's going to fund the infrastructure, and who's going to operate the urban development in that area, and that it's going to be a city doing it. A fear they had was the county might step in and try to. It is our policy in the region that new urban areas should be governed by cities that provide the most comprehensive oversight of urban development. So the 2040 map, this is where we are now. This shows the overall map of what's in the urban boundary, the urban growth boundary, and the brown areas are the urban reserves. So to be clear, we've added about 26,000 acres to that urban growth boundary over the last 15 years, only a percentage of which has developed to date. And we have a further 23,000 acres now in the urban reserves that we can choose from as we look to expand the boundary. And just a note, as you may recall, we fund we provide funding for cities to do planning and propose urban growth boundary expansions prior to that expansion. At the moment, we only have about 1,000 acres of land queued up that cities want to study and are considering requesting additions for.
Yes, I can skip this one, but this Andy just covered this.
Yep.
So we'll move to the next section that Representative Clem led off with, how we calculate buildable land supply. This is a map that shows urban growth boundary expansions over time. And as you can see, if you inspect it carefully, that there's been an urban growth boundary expansion almost every year since 1979, though, of course, the major ones come less frequently than that. As you may know, Metro is the only jurisdiction in the state that's required to reevaluate our UGB every 6 years. It used to be every 5 years. Now it's every 6 years. The way we do this has changed over time. We just described a major change, which is the addition of urban and rural reserves, and Andy described also that we now require concept planning before an UGB expansion. But clearly that UGB has not been static. So the basics of how we calculate our analytical work that leads to a UGB decision are that we calculate, we have a population and jobs forecast, and then we calculate our buildable land supply within the urban growth boundary. In other words, who's coming to the region, what we anticipate in birth over death. There's your population growth. There's a factor that helps you to determine how many jobs to expect and how much, industrial and commercial land would be needed, and then how much capacity we have to accommodate those people. We do this by looking at the local zoning and calculating what is the capacity in the region based on local zoning. And then we work back from that by discounting out land on a parcel-by-parcel basis that is unlikely to develop for a variety of reasons. Either it's a wetland, it's a steep slope, it's already got something on it that is valuable but less than the zoning would allow but is not likely to redevelop. We're going to need land for roads and sidewalks in any kind of an expansion area. We back that out. And we end up with a capacity that is, in the most recent analysis, less than half of the actual zoned capacity of the region. So that's the basics of how we do it. And then it goes to the council for their decision about what to do. The specific question that came up last session was around Damascus, and as Andy testified at that time, we are already not counting the entire eastern half of the city of Damascus. The way this came about is that our council went out to and had a joint meeting with the city council of Damascus. Damascus, because it never was able to adopt a concept plan, we couldn't base, or a comprehensive plan, we couldn't base our analysis on their zoning because they didn't have zoning. So we went out and had a conversation with them, and based on that conversation, they recommended that we zero out essentially the eastern half of their city. This is before they disincorporated, obviously. And so that's what we did. And you'll hear more about that from Ben from the city of Happy Valley, because the bottom line here is that a lot of this land in the former city of Damascus, even though nothing happened for a long time, something will happen and is already starting to happen based on annexation into the city of Happy Valley. And before I move on, I want to remind you about Damascus, that it was brought into the boundary under a fundamentally different set of land use rules than we have today. Urban and rural reserves did not exist. We were required to go to so-called exception land before farmland, which that's what was in Damascus. And so things have fundamentally changed since that happened. That wouldn't happen today, but it did happen then, and this is what's happening with it now. So we're tempted to call this last section, it's not all about the UGB. But we just wanted to offer you some additional information as a backdrop for your conversation, especially about where development is and isn't happening and why, and the role of land use and other factors in housing supply and housing affordability. The Metro Council's one of the changes is they're taking a much more outcomes-based approach to decision-making on the UGB. Bringing land into the boundary doesn't result in the outcome that we're seeking, which is housing. It doesn't always result in the outcome that we're seeking, which is the provision of housing. And so that's why we've made some of the changes in the process that we've already discussed. And I think you've seen this slide, and sorry the writing's so small, but basically the old system was that we would pick a number we had to hit, we would expand the UGB based on soil types, and then after that we'd plan for development to occur. And that wasn't really working. Development wasn't occurring. And so the new system, again, is that we plan before we bring the land into the UGB, and then we have a much better sense that the land will actually be served and actually produce housing for people. Just want to note again where housing is being produced. From over the last two decades, essentially, almost 90% of the housing that's been produced has been in the urban growth boundary that was originally established in 1979. So the bottom line here is that you need three things for housing to get developed. One is land, one is governance, and one is finance. And if you only have land, you don't get housing. The largest barrier to development in the UGB is finance for infrastructure in these new greenfield areas, as compared to land that's in the original UGB that's already got urban infrastructure, which is one major reason why the development is happening there. On average, in the UGB expansion areas, it takes about 16 years for a house to get built. The average house is built 16 years after the land it's built on is brought into the UGB. So, that's that. We're going to click through a bunch of slides very quickly to show you things that are happening in the land that's been in the UGB for nearly 40 years, just to show you the kind of capacity that's being produced in our existing urban areas. And I'll just zoom through these.
So these are in Inner Portland, Northeast Portland, near the MAC station, up North Williams Avenue, way North Portland, St. John's. The Pearl District, the north part of the Pearl District, is now really popping after the Green Line was put in. More Pearl District. South Waterfront has really seen an increased boom. And then out in Hillsborough, Orenco Station, this is the platform, which is in downtown Beaverton, beginning to see apartments go up. So then you switch to farmland areas. The blue line, if you can see the blue line around that, is a UGB expansion area from 2002. And essentially the form of development hasn't changed. This is Springwater near Gresham. Most of that was intended for industrial, but there's some housing. Pleasant Valley is a much older expansion area. It's bordered by Portland and Gresham. Portions of it have been developed, but there are some infrastructure challenges that it overcome to get full development in that area. Happy Valley, you can see a lot more housing happening there in a 1998 expansion. Beaver Creek, Oregon was held up by annexation, an issue that was addressed a couple years back, but still awaiting annexation and development. Frog Pond and Wilsonville was added to UGB more recently, but still has not yet seen development. The main area that we've been talking about for flexibility is just north of that last one near Wilsonville. Villebois has had fits and starts over time, but a lot more development there. These are two expansion areas. It's a little hard to see. There's two shades of blue. but one earlier expansion that has developed out and a newer one. This is just on the west side near between Wilsonville and Tualatin. That one actually was waiting on a road to be built out to the 99 connector. That whole process took years to sort through, and now we're awaiting the cities to come to agreement on the proper arrangement of industrial and housing land in that area. This is South Sherwood, also had been held up by not getting annexed to the city. I believe that has now been annexed. And this is South Cooper Mountain, also.
Should I just keep it?
Yeah. South Hillsborough was added in 2010, and the city has done a lot of work to figure out how to get road over the rail there. Very innovative financing approach, working with the county. So that should be coming on soon. Witch Hazel is an older expansion, another area that we might be considering in the near future for some expansion. And then, keep going, is there a Bethany one?
Yeah. There is.
Yeah, the number of these areas were added in the Grand Bargain, so they have not seen much change of that was as well. North Bethany, yeah, that's a good example of the counties overseeing the development here. There is development occurring there, but it took a long time to figure out after the housing crash how to finance all the infrastructure, and in particular the infrastructure from this development down to the freeway outside of the UDP area. And this is Bonnie Slope.
So a couple of final slides. This indicates one of the problems we have with affordability right now, which is that people have continued moving to the Portland region, and yet during the recession, there was a big slowdown in housing production. Let's break that down a little bit further. You can see that the big slowdown occurred largely within the pre-existing 1979 UGB, but you can really compare the number of units that are being produced in UGB expansion areas versus the number that are being produced in the land that was originally in the UGB. And so that slowdown was essentially associated with credit availability in the recession, and that has affected every major urban area in the country. And last year we compiled all these headlines from all over the country about how virtually every growing urban area in the country is experiencing a housing crisis, an affordability crisis, an availability crisis. It's not about the UGB. It's about a lot of growth happening and a lot of development not happening in these areas. And so I'll just leave you with this set of headlines that you can peruse at your leisure. Just wanted to bring that to your attention. And then I think we can stop, and hopefully we did it fast enough for the chair.
Yeah, no, that's great. You made up some time. A headline today that says a short supply of homes for sale is stifling activity in the Portland real estate market, which is similar to all of these.
There's one important thing that Randy said there, though, and that was that in a lot of these other places across the United States, there is no UGB,
right.
And they have the same headlines.
Yeah. Yeah, I think your point was that the market takes time for development community to want to wade back into and be able to get financing to wade back into, whether there's supply or not. It's
exactly
the risk of whether or not we can afford, whether they can afford to take the risk or not. And as they get more comfortable, then they'll build more.
Right.
Okay, so let's take a question or two, then we'll go to other speakers, and then we may have you come back. Oh, sorry, yes, we need to hear about Damascus.
Sure.
Or Happy Valley.
Can you bring Damascus? Ben's thing up.
Thank you, Chair Clem, and thank you, Vice Chair McLean, members of the committee. Thanks for the opportunity to discuss this and share, maybe take the regional approach and share a little bit of a local story. I'm Ben Bryant, Assistant City Manager for Happy Valley, and I was asked by Mr. Tucker to provide a little bit more of a local context, particularly as it relates to our plans in Happy Valley, now that the former city of Damascus has disincorporated, and there have been a lot of questions that Mr. Tucker highlighted a little bit. How do we analyze the buildable land of that area that there are a lot of questions about, is that realistic or not? So I want to provide a little bit about what's going on. I like to see maps, and I'm a very visual person, so I thought I'd show a little bit. Damascus, when it was brought into the urban growth boundary, was about 12,000 acres. And as you can see from the aerial picture, much of that was rural. What's harder to tell in this two-dimensional map is the challenging topography. So much work has been done by the former city of Damascus, as well as Clackamas County, Metro, and now City of Happy Valley, to really analyze what's realistic. And so what you see here is what we determined a higher serviceability area versus the rest. You can see that about half of the former city of Damascus is what we would call more in that higher serviceability. Largely that's due to topography and the cost effectiveness to provide utility services. It gets back to the point of the financing being one of those critical pieces. Governance also has a critical piece in what can happen. What you can see from this serviceability map, too, and I'm going to go to the next map, is it largely mirrors an earlier map that you saw from Mr. Tucker on what lands were excluded from their buildable lands inventory. And so you can see largely that yellow line is that service, higher serviceability line. Something else I want to point out that's in this map that you'll see in some future ones is we're anticipating growth to happen in phases, very similar to the colors as shown on this map. So with all that background in mind, in the last year, so the city of Damascus just incorporated in the end of June of 2016. Within a year, we had annexed City of Happy Valley over 1,000 acres. Something I want to point out is the city has done zero outreach in terms of requesting annexations. That's been 100% property owner initiated. They're filling out forms. They're coming to us and saying, we want to be part of the city of Happy Valley.
They came here first and asked, can you please disincorporate so we can go to Happy Valley?
Yes.
I remember them.
Yes. Thank you.
Very clear.
Yep, absolutely. So what's next? And while this area is annexed, much of it has retained its Clackamas County rural zoning. And it's incumbent on the city now to work with the property owners, work with Clackamas County, Metro, ODOT, DLCD, all of our partners, to come up with an integrated land use and transportation plan, a comprehensive plan. You may know Damascus tried to do that for that entire area, and it wasn't successful for a variety of reasons. We are fortunate in the city to be able to take this in phases rather than try to bite too much off of the apple. So what we are proposing to do is take about a 2,000-acre area, mostly those properties that have annexed as well as some others that will logically annex once development pressure mounts and there's a financial incentive for them to, and do a comprehensive plan update. And we'll do this in phases. And to bring us sort of back full circle, one of the reasons why we're going to do it in phases is because we've had success. I think you saw an earlier map. Many of those UGB expansion areas hadn't had much development. Wilsonville and Happy Valley are kind of the two areas where you have seen some development. In 2002, when the metro boundary was expanded to include Damascus, it actually expanded Happy Valley quite a bit as well. And that area that was part of Happy Valley is now home to two new elementary schools, a new middle school. There are 2,000 homes that are either, or units that have either been constructed or are in process. We have a 200,000 square foot shopping center anchored by Fred Meyer. You've got roads, parks, utilities. So that was all done because we did a small 2,000-acre comprehensive plan, phased approach, and that's sort of what we're anticipating to mimic that and keep going farther east. So that's all I've got, and if there are any questions, happy to answer them.
Okay, we could do one or two now, but I may have them come back up after our next speakers. Do you want to do something now?
No, I'll wait.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, Representative Power.
Thank you. I was going back to your slide with information on units in the queue, and it ends at 2016. We saw sort of a slight uptick around within the UGB, and I'm pulling it up right now. So
the graph.
Yep. Total permitted housing units per year.
A little downtick at the very end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, when do you get 2017 numbers? Because this isn't aligning with what I've heard from suburban communities. I confirmed with Milwaukee that they have an unprecedented amount of units in the queue. And my friend who's a Beaverton city councilor said they have a significantly large amount going out in Beaverton, too. And I heard Happy Valley has something like 1,200 in the queue. So it seems like the suburbs are really seeing a lot of growth. When do we get that information reflected here?
I don't know the answer to when we actually get the 2017 numbers. We can look into that and get back to you, and we'd be happy to provide figures like that as soon as we have them on hand.
But it's also worth noting that both Beaverton and Milwaukee, I believe, were in the original 1979 UGB. So they're suburban communities. We were not focusing on the city of Portland. We were focusing on the overall UGB, whereas, you know, some of Happy Valley was, I don't know if any of it was in the original 1979 UGB, but obviously some of it's been expansion areas.
So just to underscore your point, we're seeing housing production across the region in cities, in near town centers across the region. So it comports with our experience.
Okay, great. I just wanted to see.
That's just the latest data we had.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
We can certainly provide much more, you know, granular data on a city-by-city basis, et cetera. We just, you know, we didn't today, but.
It strikes me as though the plans in the queue for a long time are starting to come to fruition. A lot of those town centers are beginning to infill. And so I was hoping to see that information updated and reflected to what we're seeing.
We can do that.
Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. And I'd like to get our next panel up. This is Dr. Seltzer and Mildner from PSU.
Thanks, guys. Oh, great. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Representative Clem, members of the committee, thanks so much for the invitation to be here today. And Representative McClain, great to see you again. I kind of feel like we're talking a little bit about kind of the story of Representative McClain's life, because she was involved in a lot of this history in years past. What I want to do today in response to the invitation from the committee is to just say a few things about the context for this urban growth report, why we do it. You know, a few things about urban reserves, because I think there's some really interesting history there.
I think I have to have you say your name for the
record. Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Ethan Seltzer, Emeritus Professor of Portland State University, Toulon School of Urban Studies and Planning. Sorry. And then finish up with some comments about the urban growth report in general. So let's give this a whirl. You know, we're growing. We don't grow all that fast. It's kind of interesting. Oregon is described kind of in over time by historians as, you know, a history of a quiet summer day by a slow-moving stream. You know, we're not like California. We're not like other places that really boom. We're also a place that grows largely through in-migration, and this is a really important point, which is to say that, I mean, we grow profoundly by in-migration. Oregon, state of Oregon, 54% of the people who live in the state weren't born in the state, which is a very high percentage. The city of Portland itself, 61% of the people in the city of Portland were not born in the state of Oregon. There's only one other city on the West Coast with a higher percentage, and that's Vancouver, British Columbia. We have more in-migrants living in our state and in our major cities than California, than Washington, than any other state. Incidentally, for those of you who like these historical things, there's an arrow. Whoops, let's go back here. There's an arrow. Whoops. Let's see if we can do this. An arrow kind of right around 1972. That's when Tom McCall made his apocryphal speech saying, you know, by all means, you know, visit, but don't stay. And what you'll notice is that right after that, we entered a profound period of rapid in-migration from other parts of the country. So that's our history. What it also means is that our housing markets, our land markets, are not controlled within the local areas of the state of Oregon. They're actually linked pretty profoundly to other housing markets and other parts of the nation and the world. You know, and I think many of you probably have heard stories about people coming from other states, some of them to the south of us, you know, who come here with a lot of equity, which bids up the price and really changes things. And that is far beyond anything we can do with land supply or any other kind of policy here in the city, the state of Oregon. Randy showed this map as well. So there's a couple things about this that I think are important. One is that this shows you 1998 to 2014 or 2017, depending on which one you use. But what it doesn't show you is what's been going on in about the last 5 years. And so you would see a lot more intensity in the very center of the region and around the town centers than generally across the region. The other thing is that the 1979 urban growth boundary was enormous. And if there, if that was a legal term, enormous, you know, I mean, that would be the right term to use because it was so huge that there was actually no way to justify the amount of land inside the urban growth boundary simply using projections of population and employment growth. And it required some amazing gymnastics to get it through the acknowledgement process. But, you know, we have been dealing with a very large land supply for a very long time. A lot of what we have inside the urban growth boundary is, in fact, single-family housing set aside for single-family housing. This is the zoning map of the city of Portland. The yellow shades primarily are the single-family zones. And when you actually total up the land area of the city of Portland dedicated to various kinds of uses, what you discover is that, you know, between the single-family, you know, the exclusive single-family zones, right-of-way, and open space, we've kind of placed over 60% of the land area of the city of Portland off-limits to a variety of forms of housing that are now in high demand. In fact, we've concentrated them in just a few places. And so part of this is to say that it's not just about where the line is. It's also about the expectations we create for what happens within the line. Absolutely crucial. And, you know, one of the things I think we need to think about is whether early 20th century designations for land use in cities are appropriate to, you know, 21st century markets and interests on the part of people who are coming here and living here and making a life here. Here we have the urban growth boundary. Map up in the upper right is a map actually of the cities within the urban growth boundary and around the urban growth boundary. We use the term city here in Oregon pretty loosely. City of Portland, 640,000 people. City of Johnson City, 450 people, both legally regarded in the same kind of way. And we divide up kind of who does what kinds of planning. This to say that the urban growth boundary, when it was originally conceived, was conceived as a means for coordinating the activities among all of those different cities within the urban growth boundary. You know, with every city basically creating its own comprehensive plan, every city and county, the question becomes, how do you knit the pieces together? And the urban growth boundary is an essential component of doing that. Metro does not have the authority to do a comprehensive plan. The state has no state plan. And so in many ways, we kind of depend on things like the urban growth boundary to make sense of it all, to connect things to each other. And that's why coming up with a regional forecast and a regional land supply is absolutely crucial, because without that, we really don't have any kind of basis for coordination. The other thing I'll say is that when you look at the distribution of population and of things within the state of Oregon, and you look at the Willamette Valley, which is about 100 miles long, and you realize that 80% of the population of the state, 75 to 80%, is found within the Willamette Valley, that 80 to 85% of the population of the state is found within 10 miles of either side of I-5, that this is the epicenter for trying to figure out how this coordination works and how these things come together. And once we move land from rural to urban, it's a one-way street. We can't get it back. Now, technically, we have processes that allow people to trade their land from urban back to rural. But no one does it, because actually there's a price premium that applies to urban land. And so when we reward property with that price premium, we just can't take it back. It never happens. So we need to be really careful. Once the toothpaste is out of the tube, as they say, you can't get it back in. This is a map of metropolitan areas in Oregon, just to show that almost the entire Willamette Valley is within one metropolitan area or another. But this is a map of farmland sales or farm sales, also to make the point that in the metropolitan area, Washington and Clackamas counties, you know, which if you remember back to that spiky map of housing development are, you know, typically within the top 10 of Oregon counties in agricultural sales. We have succeeded to some degree in sustaining farmland and farming within the most densely populated, fastest-growing location in the entire Columbia River Basin, which is kind of phenomenal, which is why the urban growth boundary is of interest to people from all over the world. Finally, this is the map that Randy showed a few minutes ago of the urban growth concept. To make the point that before we had urban reserves, and we played around with this concept back in about 1991, and it didn't really take. It didn't really take until 2007 in the form that passed the legislature and kind of made much more sense than what we were trying to do back in 1991. But the point was that if you look at the urban growth boundary, it's about 225 miles long. And prior to the designation of urban reserves, every single foot of that 225-mile boundary was a site for speculation. And if you talk to farmers outside the urban growth boundary now, urban reserves haven't taken away speculation. But what we hope is that over time, it will lessen the speculation that every property owner within a number of miles of the urban growth boundary is subject to at this point in time. We also hope that the designation of urban reserves will help to focus the attention of the market on the future urban land in such a way that it begins to assemble those properties, begins to start the conversation about services. Because at the end of the day, you know, these things like sewer and water and parks and roads have to be paid for by somebody. And we are no longer going to be building starter homes at the edge of the urban growth boundary. In fact, quite the contrary. All of those costs get loaded on the sales price of the houses. And that means that the households that are coming to these newly developing areas at the edge are going to be paying probably some of the highest costs in the metropolitan region. Now, when we started with suburbanization post-World War II, the federal government did us a huge favor and provided a tremendous amount of money in a variety of forms to provide streets, sewers, water systems, even parks. Those transfers have all ended. In fact, they ended a number of years ago. This is not a new thing. They ended decades ago. And one of the issues we've had is where does the money come from to make these things happen? We still have that. So land does not equal affordability under any kind of scenario here is, I guess, the point I want to make. Last point is for urban reserves. One of the big issues we have with farming in the metropolitan region is succession planning on the part of farmers. Enabling young farmers to get into the business means enabling them to get access to the land. If the speculative pressure isn't ameliorated in some way, we won't have the succession that enables some of the most productive farmland in the state and in the world to remain as part of the inventory. Okay, Urban Growth Report. You can read this as well as I can, so I'm not going to read it to you except to say that what Metro has been doing is remarkable in terms of its transparency and the ability of people to both be involved in the process and to follow where the, you know, footsteps have led from forecast to buildable land inventory. And I'd be happy to talk more about that, but in the interest of time, I think I'll pass the remote to my colleague. Sound good?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you for inviting me. My name is Jerry Milner. I'm a professor at Portland State as well. I'm an economist by training. I was a colleague of Dr. Seltzer for 15 years in the School of Urban Studies and Planning, and I'm now a professor in the business school, and I head up our Center for Real Estate. Just give some preliminary data just to talk about where Portland's housing market is at right now. We've fully recovered from the Great Recession. We lost about a third in value compared to what we had been at the peak. In terms of rents, we've seen some very fast rates of appreciation. The Great Recession had a lot of impacts on how millennials were shopping for housing, and they shifted in many ways from single-family to multifamily. They delayed marriages. They delayed family formation. Some of that appreciation has moderated in the last few years. Housing production remains a big issue for our region. So this is looking at housing production from a four-county perspective. I think it only makes sense. housing markets in their, you know, make sense at a metropolitan level, not at a city level or a county level or individual jurisdiction level. The big change that happened since the Great Recession has been, first of all, a lot of housing that wasn't built, probably a deficit of about 50,000 units, and also a shift from single-family to multifamily. So multifamily production has gone up, but it's by no means a peak of what it's been, but single-family production has come way down. Looking forward, this looks at CoStar's forecast for multifamily production in our metropolitan area moving forward, and they're projecting a big decline. And I think in part it's, you know, I think one thing that's on the minds of a lot of multifamily developers right now is the inclusionary zoning provisions that the city of Portland has put in place. If you build housing 20 units or more, you're going to have to provide for 20% of those units to be affordable indefinitely. A lot of applications were submitted prior to the February 1 deadline. We're not quite sure what we're going to see moving forward. There's some strategies where you build a lot of 19-unit apartment buildings. And I think there's a question about whether some of those permits that were submitted before February 1 may take a year, maybe 2 years to implement. So it may take us a long time to realize what the true impacts are for this for the city of Portland implementing inclusionary zoning. There's some expectation that the suburbs will make up for this. Well, what I will say is that if we look at the years most recently, since the Great Recession, suburban construction is down. You know, you can point to a few places like a Renko Station. You can find individual apartment complexes that have been built. But the suburbs traditionally have seen a lot of single-family construction. And when the single-family construction comes down, that's most egregiously affected each one of our three suburban counties. So from a point of view of a single-family developer, they're looking at the leftover parcels, the rattier parcels, the ones which don't have as good a freeway access, the ones which are more steeply sloped than before. In terms of the impact of a policy that emphasizes a lot of density, I think we have to recognize that building high density costs a lot more. So this comes from some work we did for Holland Development a couple of years ago. They're the ones who developed the platform project at Renko Station that was referenced earlier. And what we did was we got several years' worth of data on apartment construction and looked at the rents being charged. And if you look at garden apartments, basically meaning two-story apartments, maybe with a tuck-under parking, those typically were coming in at about $1 to $1.20 per square foot in terms of the rent price. And typically these were located in the fringes of the metropolitan area. If you go to the next development type that's usually done, that's usually a 4-over-1, 5-over-1 construction where you build a concrete platform and then you build wood construction above it. Those are being priced at the $1.70 to $2.10 range per square foot. And then finally, if you go beyond that, there's some experimentation right now with cross-laminated timber, but generally speaking, you have to go to steel and concrete construction, true high-rise, and that pushes $3 a square foot. So my point being that if you're looking at the pricing for units, if you're relying upon a strategy that relies strictly on town center, strictly on downtown construction, South Waterfront, Pearl District, maybe Gateway, you're looking at a higher price point. And I think what's going to happen as we have difficulties developing in Portland, or we have this regulatory burden of inclusionary zoning, is that multifamily developers will look at places like Milwaukee and they'll look at places like Beaverton, but they're only going to be building in those places until rents in those places hit those levels. Generally speaking, rents within our region can peak along a spine along the Willamette River. And so picking these other places, I mean, they'd love to go to Lake Oswego, for example, if only they could get the regulatory permission to do so. So I think a couple lessons I think are worth talking about. One is that if you're concerned about affordable housing, if you're concerned about housing that's lower priced, it's a vintage good. And so we should have been building it 20 years ago or 10 years ago in order for it to depreciate and become less expensive. It's about $100,000 premium between old and new. Secondly, if you're looking at it from a lens of poor people, most poor people rent at market levels. And so I think one of the challenges we have to face as a region is looking at housing affordability strictly as something that's provided by regulatory fiat or provided by, you know, some kind of a subsidy program. That's only going to help a portion of the poor. You're going to be helping a few out. So what this does is look at all of the households in the United States. It's national data. Look at all the households in the United States below the poverty line and then totaling up all of the units that are out there in the various regulatory programs. Now, I agree completely with Dr. Seltzer that the urban growth boundary, when it was initially established, was very generous. It would be like giving me a size 36-inch belt when I was a teenager. There was lots of room to grow. But over time, we have grown. Our metropolitan area in the last 40 years has grown by approximately 80% in population, but our growth boundary has only grown by 10. And as was discussed earlier, a good portion of that 10% growth was in a place where people didn't want to live, Damascus, and the local residents didn't want the people moving there. It's a bit like if I was trying to wear the same shirt my mother gave me in junior high. I think we need to accept that the growth boundary does need to be bigger, and how it happens, whether it happens at the local level, whether it takes a state legislature to do it like it did with the Grand Bargain, we'll see. This is a document, or this is an image from a document by the City of Portland, and tries to show where they think housing production is going to be happening over the next 20 years. And when you look at their before and after photo, and I'll just give you kind of a toggle here, they emphasized a lot of growth in Gateway and 82nd Street and Montevilla. Now, I've lived on the west side now for 10 years, and I used to live on the east side, and I was kind of freaked out when I saw that image. I took a drive, went down 82nd Street. It's still the same one I remember. Uh-huh. Used car lots, senior house, Chinese food, Mexican food. There's just not a lot of high-density construction happening in this area. Yet a lot of our regional plans are based on the assumption that this high-density zoning that the City of Portland has in mid-county, east county area will in fact materialize. And I think that's a big issue for us to face at a local level. This is a similar map from Metro and shows where they perceive the opportunities for redevelopment. So Metro is looking at a very heavy redevelopment strategy, a tear-down rebuild strategy for providing housing for the next 20 years. Now, I will say that in the last year, Metro staff has come up with some new techniques for trying to analyze this, so I don't want to be entirely negative about this. They have tried to put an economic filter on whether some of this property will be redeveloped. I think it's critical to watchdog what's happening to make sure that we recognize that when rents in East County are $1 or $1.10 per square foot, they're not going to support five-story construction. The zoning is generous, and I don't want to change that. I think it's very helpful along our avenues and our town centers to have generous zoning, but I think we have to recognize that we can't take it at face value. Metro, in their 2015 urban growth report, solved the problem, but they solved the problem by assuming that we would see a very rapid increase in rents, assuming that we would be seeing rents that would reach the levels in California, San Francisco, and Los Angeles. From an economist's point of view, this will not happen. This can happen. I mean, right now we make our bread and butter as a region by attracting firms from the Bay Area, attracting firms from California to move to our region. We don't have the same kind of density of opportunities, research opportunities, as in those other places, but at least we have affordable housing. And I think if we move to this model of densification to the degree that's being proposed, I think we're going to run into some economic growth problems. So my advice is that we should be opening up these urban reserves. We should be analyzing them carefully. I've worked with a team of students to try to analyze this over each one of these urban reserves. I think one of the conclusions that we came to is that the reserves on the west side are a lot more marketable and a lot more likely to develop than the ones on the east side. And so I think I think attention needs to be paid to that. I'd also say that for these towns right now have a deadline of December 31 to propose sites. And I was a bit distressed to hear that only 1,000 acres are being proposed for expansion. My rationale on that is that it's a in some ways, for a town to be proposing 1,000 acres or 2,000 acres to be included in an urban growth boundary, in some ways they're taking one for the team. If our housing markets are regional, then the benefit from new housing production isn't going to just accrue to Beaverton, isn't just going to accrue to Hillsborough, isn't just going to accrue to Sherwood. It's going to be spread across the entire region. So if we moderate home prices, the benefits are spread across many, many areas, but the costs, presumably, in terms of infrastructure, in terms of crowded schools, are going to accrue to individual towns. So I think what's really called for is some kind of a regional fund that will help out these towns, to help them do the planning to produce these urban reserve areas, and so that it makes it easier for them to say yes.
Great. Thank you, gentlemen. We are past our committee time, but let's take a few questions until somebody kicks us out of the room. And if committee members have to leave because you already had things scheduled 11, totally understand. It's not that they don't like you all. It's just that I didn't manage our time very well. But Vice Chair McLean.
I would have to be here for 2 hours to be able to deal with everything I just heard. And you're right. I feel like, you know, I gave up my youth to get us to 2007, you know, so that in 2007 we could actually get to see those things actually get built and infrastructure and governance actually get addressed, and really talking about what you can create with a small boundary and what you can create with a large boundary. And our experience of it took 50 years and we still haven't used up the 1979 boundary. And I would disagree with some of the things from the last speaker. I really want to get together and have coffee. Because I have Hillsborough, I have Forest Grove, and the experiences that you are talking about aren't my experiences right now in those areas. I have one development that's behind me that has had four stages that started in 2003, and now we're in 2017. They're to stage four now because it does have to be pieced out, as our Happy Valley city manager pointed out, if we want to be able to pay for the infrastructure, the streets, and the parks and everything else that we need to have a full-service community and have the values addressed that most of our community members want our cities to address. Let's look at Bethany and talk about counties and governance and what happened up there and why we turned in 2007 to a governance of cities need to be the folks that are doing those comprehensive plans before we actually start the development, so we know that the roads and the schools and the other amenities and essential services can actually be there for the houses, whether they be duplexes or they're single family. Or, you know, I've got three projects in Forest Grove right now. One's a simple apartment. One is, I think you called it stage three or something, on a platform with, you know, with wood above it. We've got a couple of apartments going in on the other side. We've got single family going, not just in that stage four, but we've got like over 150 to 200 acres being developed as we speak. You know, I mean, it takes that, you know, step it out and figure out how the infrastructure comes. Something else that Ethan said that I thought was so important, and that is, remember that we are 54 to 61%, whatever it was in state, of folks coming in, you know, the in-migration, and they're bringing money with them, and they're willing to hand it out. My daughter just bought on 82nd, by the way, which we do have PC Community Campus on 82nd. It's pretty cool, and it's pretty high. There's at least three or four, you know, floors on some of that. And they stood in line for 17 months trying to buy that house, but it was the people coming in. She's a sixth-generation Oregonian, but there were the people that were coming in that had the $20,000 of, here, can I give that to you, and we'll pay the rest in cash tomorrow. And so, you know, we've got to deal with in-migration. We've got to deal with folks coming with resources. We've got to deal with the fact that good planning means infrastructure planning before you start, and developers actually putting things together, as was pointed out, so that you can actually build and make some money. And we could talk about inclusionary zoning all day long, and the idea that there are some issues here on having affordable housing along the scale, from what you are calling the poorest of people who might be renting to folks that actually may be at the lower levels of the middle income folks that want to own a home. And so, you know, there's a lot of issues there on the fact that we've got to deal with a wide variety of incomes and a wide variety of circumstances, including that development cash and capital and ability to borrow, so that we can again step out those, you know, those types of developments. But thank you all for being here, and it's been a lovely review, and we have so much more to do, and I look forward to it.
Rep. McHugh.
Well, I just wanted to thank you for a robust conversation. I come from a town where an urban growth boundary is not a daily topic of conversation, but it's certainly interesting for me to be better educated about it, and Representative McLean does a fine job of keeping me up to speed on some of these issues. I just wanted to take a minute and recognize our newest member, Representative Salinas, is in the room today. This is her first day sitting in committees, I guess, after her swearing in yesterday, so I just wanted to welcome you on behalf of this
committee. We tried to get her up on the dais, but she doesn't.
Come sit. Next time.
I'm not quite ready yet.
We're going to call you out, though.
Representative Power.
I think I want to say thank you for coming and giving this presentation. I want to give you some of my thoughts as you move forward with studying this area. I'm a millennial legislator and a former city councilor, and I know there's a lot of broad characterizations about my age demographic, but the truth is you could open up those urban reserves and we would not want to live out there. The housing pressures in the cities, as we saw through Metro's presentation, are happening because, you know, we're trending towards more urban, more dense city living, where the services are, where restaurants are. I mean, most of my friends and colleagues professionally are one-car households. We are into car sharing. We are into public transportation. We also have I think the League of Oregon Cities has ascertained in the state of Oregon, we have about a $7 billion deferred infrastructure problem in water and sewer. So from a functional perspective, I can't see how we could build out that far when we can't maintain what we currently have. So I think those things in tandem lead me to think that really what we could do to facilitate faster development, more effective development, more cost-effective development, is enabling cities to do updated housing needs analysis, because we put those tools in local decision makers' hands and you learn what kind of housing you actually do need, not just what you think you need, but what you do need. Mm-hmm. I learned through Milwaukee's and going through that process myself that we desperately need affordable condo sort of townhome style purchases for entry level purchase for the next generation of millennials who don't want to own a single family home and don't want a yard to upkeep, as well as baby boomers who are downsizing. So I think finding out and uncovering some of those might dispel some myths and be a much better use of our limited mm-hmm. resources at the local level.
Yeah, I mean, people aren't being forced to pay a premium to live close to the center. Mm-hmm. Actually, they elect to do that. You know, the old real estate kind of rule of location, location, and location still applies. And I think what we're seeing is a tremendous shift in the market. Now, we still have people who want to live on a cul-de-sac at the edge of the urban growth boundary. And the good news is we're at stage four. We have places for them to do that. And I think that really is what it kind of boils down to. It's not how do we make one size fit all. It's how do we create an environment within which there's a wide range of choices, and recognize that for the millennials at this stage, yeah, absolutely. Finding a place in an urban reserve out at the edge of the urban growth boundary that requires a lot of driving is probably not high on the list.
Yeah, I hope so. I didn't offend anyone. And when you talk about groups of populations or places, you're almost guaranteed to do so. No, I think it's an open question as to what the millennial population will do. I fully agree that it's a matter of choice, and that a lot of millennials chose urban locations or central city locations and apartment living. I think. Makes all the sense in the world, right? If you're trying to meet new people, if you're trying to go out to restaurants, if you're trying to be close to work and save time, you know, what the heck? I will say, and I personally would never live on the urban fringe. I'm an infill housing buyer, but I will say that as somebody who lives on the west side and I see all of the cars going in the opposite direction, there is a desperate need for housing on the west side, and you know, if the people who are living in River Terrace, that's Polygon Homes project along Roy Rogers Road, they've got a reasonable commute if they want to get to Intel, or if they're trying to get to some kind of a West Side employer. So, and frankly, we're seeing a lot of people who are trying to kind of bridge the urban growth boundary gap. This is something that they've experienced in London for many years, people kind of bridging over the Greenbelt. So if you take a look at some of the highways in Washington County, people are going from those places of affordable housing to get to the employment centers on the West Side. I think developers will pay some of these infrastructure costs. I mean, my understanding from South Hillsborough is they're paying about $50,000 a door in infrastructure costs to make that happen. So I think, you know, when you're dealing with a new home price, I mean, I had a number on the screen, but the new one I've seen is 480 average new home price in our metropolitan area. There's a lot of room to pay for infrastructure costs, but I do think that the jurisdictions need to contribute, and I think the appropriate jurisdiction for contributing to some of that infrastructure cost, trunk roads, for example, like Roy Rogers Road, that needs to come at a pretty high level, whether it's county or whether it's metro, to facilitate more of this housing development happening.
Yeah, we've got a really interesting case study of the Pearl District, where in 2000 in the census there was one child. And the expectation was that, well, you know, when those people in the Pearl District start to have children, they will all leave. Uh-huh. Well, by 2010, there were so many children in the Pearl District that we now have an elementary school in the Pearl District. Uh-huh. And I think what it comes down to is that people are incredibly adaptable, you know, and they will locate for a wide range of reasons. It's not just about the house. But again, I think the important thing to recognize is you want to live out at the edge of the urban growth boundary, we can accommodate you. You want to live in the center of the urban area, we can accommodate you. And I hope that is always something we can say about this region.
Okay. With that, thank you, everybody, for joining us. Thanks for your attention, committee members.
Thank you.
I'm going to adjourn our interim days, and we'll see you in November, December?
November, I think.
November, December?